Supervisors, please take your seats. Steve, we're doing this in order, right? James coming first. Okay. Supervisors, please take your seats. I will call the meeting to order. Marion will take care of the roll. The computers are not on. We'll start out with the proclamation. Mr. O'Malley, he will do the proclamation as soon as he finds the proclamation.
February 2008, Public Health Month, whereas the La Crosse County Health Department improves the quality of life and health of all 110,000 people in La Crosse County, rich and poor residents and tourists, young and old, and whereas the clerical, community health aid, fiscal, environmental health, health education, laboratory, nursing, nutrition, vector control, and other staff of La Crosse County Health Department assist residents in realizing the opportunity to live a long and productive life free of preventable disease and the effects of preventable injury through the following services that are listed here in quite some detail, and now therefore be it resolved that the La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of February as Public Health Month and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of persons dedicated to improving the quality of life and health for La Crosse County residents.
Moved by Margaret Wood, second by Vicki Burke. Any discussion on this one? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Carried unanimously. Before we go on to the next item, on your desk is the conflict of interest statement that everyone needs to turn in. We need to do this once a year, and it discloses any sorts of business interests you may have and so forth that would affect your carrying out of your duties. And it doesn't necessarily mean you have a conflict, just that you disclose that you have those particular interests. So please try to sign that, add anything that would apply in your particular case, but before you leave tonight, turn it in to Marion. Any questions on that? Anybody not clear on how that works? Okay, let's go on next to the status report on the Carey Group recommendations and Jane Claycamp.
Good evening. I'm going to try to give a very brief, quick overview of what's happening with the Carey Report. On your desk, you have this set of papers, which actually gives you some idea on what's been going on with all of the recommendations in the Carey Report, but I will not be going over all 88 of them because I don't want people to sleep. So I'll be trying to go over some of the more interesting ones and the ones that have the most benefit for the moment. So there are 88 recommendations. 23, I think, will be ongoing for ever, possibly. Six have been completed. 18 are in progress. There are many steps to them. Two are being reviewed for implementation. One is a partial completion. And then there are 17 more recommendations that were out of the technical assistance request that NIC did a year ago about mental health and women in the jail. So there are also those 17 that we have to continue to work on. I'm going to focus on the comprehensive reports or the comprehensive recommendations from the Carey Report and try to link in the different recommendations that from the other parts of the report so you can see how many of these are linked together. But again, there are 88 of them, and I didn't want to tediously walk through every single one. So adopting a unifying vision is probably the most important recommendation that they made on some level because it will affect so many of the other recommendations that they made. So it will influence how we do assessments and how we work with women inmates and justice sanctions and the Criminal Justice Management Council. It really, the limited risk management really incorporates the different areas of risk and need that they have talked about with us so often, that you have to try to assess risk and need over and over again and then provide the appropriate treatment for each person. So what this does is it gives us a framework for everyone, for the judges, for the Department of Corrections, for justice sanctions, for all the different agencies within the criminal justice system, for the DA's office. So it affects many, many, many people. And it will also affect how we work with people on bond or sentence or handle also the judicial reviews. The Criminal Justice Management Council in September adapted a mission and a vision statement, and again, I'm not going to read those, but I just wanted to let you know that those had been completed. And then the second comprehensive recommendation is about jail bed usage. And again, the report recommended that a local working group convene and work through some of those different problems that were brought up in the Carey report. And again, this will affect how we handle assessments in the system and information systems. And again, there's a whole section on assessments, and there's a whole section on information systems. So there are linkages between the local working group and then those other sections. So again, as you take the time to read through it, if you feel like it, you'll be able to see that there are links between all of those. Again, I'm not going to back up, but just about the assessments. So, for example, the jail has implemented using the proxy so that the judges are now getting those when they make decisions at intake. So we've put that into place. And then in justice sanctions, this is one of the things that is in progress. We're working on taking the LSI and making that more usable in the system. So the executive committee of the Criminal Justice Management Council is trying to determine what kinds of cases the LSI should be used on to give that to the judges so that, again, they'll be able to use that in a better way. They'll be able to make more informed decisions whenever they're making a decision, whether it's, again, at bond or at sentencing on certain kinds of cases. So, again, just trying to work through all of them. The jail population risk profile, again, it links back to all the things about assessments and female inmates and justice sanctions. All of these things are so tied together. And that, again, it focuses a lot on us better utilizing the LSIR, talking about closing the women's jail, implementing gender-specific programs, incorporating gender responsiveness into different programs. So just, again, so many of these things link together. One relies on the other. And then it also, this one will focus more on restructuring justice sanctions to focus on risk reduction, which, again, we're trying to do. Then the considering a community-based intervention strategy, we haven't talked about that in any sort of detail or in any sort of meeting, but what that is trying to figure out a way to implement more programs, more community-based restorative justice programs that would, again, work more with some of the low-risk offenders versus the higher-risk offenders so that the law enforcement or the judges or different programs would have more ability to divert cases out of the system. This is going to be covered, obviously, with the LEC edition shortly, so I'm not going to talk a lot about this, if any. But it just talks about developing the jail expansion plan using the best-case scenario. So, again, what they're trying to say is if we incorporate assessments appropriately and work with the female inmates in a better way and we think about how to structure our jail and its operations and also the mental health in the jail, we will be able to have a smaller jail that will be more efficient. So they want us to plan for that rather than a larger jail. Management of female inmate population should be considered based on low risk. Again, close the women's jail and use alternate systems. This is something that we're working with the YWCA on developing the women's community-based program. So the RFP was distributed, and they bid on it and received the contract. And again, this is going to be based on justice sanctions, completing the assessments for the women, based on evidence-based practice, and then informing the Y what programs we want them to be participating in. So, for example, if they need to have their high school diploma, we'll ask them to refer them to Western and then also make sure that they follow up with that. So they will be providing the services to make sure the women get to where they need to go. And then the one about, again, these are all from the comprehensive recommendations. It says justice sanctions is designed to handle lower risk offenders too exclusively, and the different recommendations about that is we need to reduce time and resources spent on low-risk offenders. We need to differentiate supervision based on risk level and provide additional staffing and supervisors to justice sanctions. So, again, it's how they all link together is that if we use the limited risk management, we assess appropriately, we recommend people to go to the programs that they are appropriate for, then again, we should have a better, we should be able to reduce recidivism. And so those are the different areas or the different sections of the report that it links to. And then finally, it's indicating that we need to have a more seamless delivery system, and that, again, how do we all work together in the criminal justice system, whether it's the Department of Corrections, the judges, the district attorney's office, the defense attorneys, whoever it is, how do we all work together to make sure that we're on the same page and providing as much as possible a seamless delivery system? This is something that we have tried to do in the treatment courts, whether it's OWI court or drug court, where all of the players come together and talk about each person individually, and we're going to be working in that same model with the women's community-based program, and we're hoping to expand that, if the women's program goes well, into the men's population in the future. And so what, again, it's looking at each person individually and then making the best possible recommendations and providing the best services for them so that hopefully they don't come back into the system. So again, the handout on your desk gives you an update on all 88, but I just wanted to give a very brief overview on where we're at right now.
Jane, why don't you give the board an update on where things are at with the female program?
They are in the process of hiring staff, and we're working with IT to have them have access to our case management system. So again, we'll be more seamless in how we deliver services. So they'll have access to our case management system, and we'll be able to see what they're doing. And also, we are in the process of figuring out a way to locate a residence for the women. So they're in the middle of hiring staff right now.
What's the best guess as far as the time frame?
I think their plan is to have someone hired by the end of this month, and we'll be able to refer to anything but the housing at that point.
Okay. Other questions from board members? Anybody have any? Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the good report, Jane. I noticed that Sheriff Helgeson's in attendance. Is there any? I know the these issues consume a lot of justice sanctions, but they also consume the Sheriff's Department. So I guess, is there anything that you'd like to add regarding the Care Report recommendations update?
No, I don't think there is. We are working with the Criminal Justice Management Executive Committee, and we have the judges and the DA and myself, James, Steve O'Malley, probation and parole, all working to try to make it more seamless. And so a lot of these problems we are working on and making some headway on.
Tom Rauch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jane, I'd just like to ask one question, and the briefing is good. Even better is what is happening. I greatly appreciate that. Just referring, without going back to it, to your original slide where you grouped the things in their various categories, just for my edification, the definition of the word ongoing is we've gone through the assessment, we've identified how much of that or whatever we want to do, but it's not a finite object that we're done with, so we'll never be done with it, but we're in a steady state condition?
That's how I would look at it.
Thank you.
So what is the difference between ongoing and in progress?
In progress is more, I actually had that discussion internally today about whether I should just make the in progress and ongoing, and decided to leave it. In my mind, ongoing means it may never end. We might be doing it 20 years from now. In progress means there may be an end to it at some point.
Sounds good to me. Nandina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as I was watching television, and I do that once in a while, I see that about 2-3 weeks ago, a guy came up to the court finally. He was picked up for something. He was from Sparta, and I don't know the name, and I wouldn't use it anyhow. But he was ending up, he spent 9 months in court before he got before the judge. Does it normally take that long? And then he got sentenced for 1 year, and 9 months of that went toward his sentence. So, you know, are we keeping the people who get arrested for whatever in jail longer than we have to prior to them going to court and getting sentences or not sentenced?
I'll ask our resident expert to answer that one, Mr. Belzer.
I thought I was only the expert on why women are in jail.
Thank you.
I'll answer the best of my knowledge, and Jane also would have a lot of information on this as well, but that would not be usual that someone would be in jail. In what you said, I don't know if you meant to say this or not, but wouldn't be completely accurate, Don, in the sense that you would never sit for 9 months in jail without seeing a judge unless you were on some other hold. I mean, if you come in on a new case, they have to have some sort of a bond hearing within 48 hours, right? That's before a judge. Now, once there's a bond hearing, if there's a cash bond in place because of dangerousness or flight risk, then you might sit in jail that long until the case is resolved. That's not unheard of. That's sort of a long time, frankly, to sit on a cash bond. And it would be even longer time to sit on like a probation hold, 9 months. I don't think that happens very often, and certainly the sheriff could jump in here too. But if it's a case that might go to trial, then that's possible, that somebody would sit that long. Now, were they sitting in our jail or in Monroe County? You said something about Sparta. Well, it's not unheard of. It's unusual. For a lot of reasons, it's unusual. Number one, most of the guys aren't going to want to sit that long, so they're going to complain to their attorney, look, give me a trial or something. Another reason that doesn't happen that often here is because of justice sanctions. If there's some way to get somebody out of there on electronic monitoring, with bail monitoring, that's much more expensive or much more cost-effective for us and basically just as safe as long as it's somebody who's not real dangerous. It's absolutely the exception, yeah.
Jane, anything to add on that?
I was just going to say, we actually looked at that because that was one of the different areas the executive committee wanted to review was who was sitting in jail and for how long, and every time there was one like that where it was an extended period of time, there seemed to be a good reason for it. So,
other questions for Jane? Okay, thank you, Jane. That gets us to the LEC progress update, and... Who's leading the... Paul, you're doing that?
Good evening. What we want to do tonight is just give you an update on where we are in the planning process. River Architects and Potter Lawson have been meeting with the Sheriff's Department and Market & Johnson, the construction manager, and just looking at all the facilities and going through booking on almost on every two-week basis, 2 to 3 weeks. We're up here going through on a two-day schedule of details, and as we develop the plans, we're locking in where the rooms are, and then we're getting into more details, and over the next few months, we'll continue to get tighter and tighter on our details and refining things, and as we develop this process, I think we're getting a consensus of we're going in the right direction, we're just looking at, in the end, will be what the colors are on the walls. So, we're working through this process, and we'll just give you an update on where we are in the planning tonight here. What we're looking at is we'll show you the site plan. The garage design is a separate building. I think you remember from last time. It's a separate building on north on the parking lot next to D's garage. The housing renovation is a separate little renovation of the existing building that we need to get done prior to the actual construction of the main addition and renovation. And then the main building, which is the big bulk of the work, is the addition renovation, and then we'll touch on the schedule. For the garage, we're looking at the site plan. This is next to D's, which is the... Oh, there it is. The D's is that little rectangular building. And I apologize on the graphics, where these are more architectural drawings, and they're in progress, and so they're really looking at ways to make them biddable. And so this is D's garage. This would be the new garage shared by the facilities and the sheriff. And this is the existing parking lot to the north, and the Burger King is up on the north there. This is the layout of the garage, and you can see it has, this is all the sheriff's side is for these vehicle parking there. And then there's an evidence storage garage that we're putting in there. We're moving it from the existing building. So we're trying to clean out the garage for the existing garage and move it up into this one so we can have it for construction as we build the addition. The little square down... Oop, how do you go backwards? How do you go backwards?
She's trying.
Oh, okay. I'll have to keep my fingers off. This is what it looks like from the Third Street side. The facility corner is in that corner, and we've worked with facilities to put the truck with some plows and the bobcat, the snow removal, and we really just packed them in there. So it's really tight. It's only to store them there, and then the rest would be for the sheriff. And it's a parking garage. It's not a repair garage. It's not classified as for any repairs or any work on vehicles. We'll probably be able to clean cars and wash cars, but beyond that, it's classified by code as a parking garage. And you can see there's access to the north onto the little street north of D's, and then access to the south, which is into the parking lot. This is the view from the north side, and these are becoming more and more developed, and we'd like your consensus so that we can proceed with the design of these and get these out on the street for bidding. And so keep that in mind as we show you these. This would be the side from the Third Street looking at it, you know, from the parking lot. This would be looking over the cars in the parking lot, and this would be the side, the view from the south, looking at it from the law enforcement center side. If you looked out the window of the sheriff's department, that's what you would see. So it's pretty much a basic garage. What we tried to do with that is to bring in some of the vocabulary that you'll see in the existing building with the windows and the colored block, but we're keeping it economical. That's all block material that you see there. It's nothing elaborate, and it's a rectangular, it's a box. It's a square box with a steel roof and...
Let me stop you at that point. I want to ask a question because I know board members have gotten correspondence, and there was a letter to the editor from the dive rescue team saying, hey, can't we put our stuff in here? And I see we have both the sheriff and Jim Spiropoulos here, and I know that issue has been discussed, and I guess knowing the board members are going to ask that question while we're on this, can I get any comment that either Jim or Steve have with regard to that issue?
Sure, we've looked at it, but the space is going to be tight. We don't feel it right now, given the size, that we're going to be able to accommodate a dive rescue, although I do think it's important that we try to accommodate dive rescue in some way. We're looking at Hillview Garage. The Sheriff's Department currently has a couple of stalls at Hillview in one of the garages there that we store evidence and records in right now. So if we possibly could find some place to put those records, we might be able to free up a stall that might work. That's some of the things we're looking at right now, some other options.
Thank you. Jeff Schrader.
Can I ask a question on a...
Sure.
You said there's going to be evidence storage in there. Is there any...
The evidence is a vehicle evidence bay, one bay for a vehicle that's stored there. It comes out of the existing garage, and we're probably going to move the same fencing that's around the evidence bay. It's a for one car, I think, is all they do it. You process it there?
Right. We process it there, and also for other large evidence. If we, for example, had a safe or something, we wouldn't want to try to carry it, get it up to the second floor. So we keep large, heavy evidence and vehicle that would need to be processed for that type of thing.
So it doesn't necessarily need to be secure then?
Well, it needs to be secure.
It has a cage around it. It's like a metal cage, like chain link fence. About 16 by 24 is the size, and it's got a garage door.
You can answer questions over the microphone. You get very sick today, so you can... That way everybody can...
Any other questions on the garage? Yes.
Jill.
The facility vehicles that will be in there, where are they presently?
Jim Spiropoulos will answer that.
Currently, we have about two and a half stalls down in the existing LEC garage, and they're not so much for vehicles but for snow removal equipment in the wintertime. A lot of times in the summertime, the Sheriff's Department uses a portion of it, but it's more snow removal equipment for the campus. So we don't necessarily store vehicles in there.
Okay, thank you. And the second question is, will there be anything under the garage? Will there be a basement under the garage?
No, it's slab on grade. Trying to keep the cost down, it's a concrete slab. Remove the parking lot there, level it off, and build a block, four block walls, and put a roof on it.
Thank you.
Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spoke about this at our Public Property Infrastructure Committee meeting tonight, and I think the board should consider a storage facility for the dive team boat and equipment. But I guess my question is this. Will our need for storage space change as our LEC operations expand? I mean, we're planning the LEC addition in phases. We're not going to occupy. We're going to shell the building. We're not going to use all the resources we could immediately. And I guess my question then is, why wouldn't our need for storage space also increase? Or is there absolutely no correlation between storage space currently and where we'll be in 30 years? Are you saying that we won't have any more need for storage space in 30 years? Because that's basically what we're doing, right?
Okay, who wants to tackle that one?
Well, Jim's coming forward, I know he can touch on this.
He is.
One of the advantages to what we have with all the unfinished area that will eventually be remodeled into receiving is we can handle a lot of record storage and some other things that won't impact our ability when we end up remodeling that. The other advantage to the garage as it's designed right now is if 10, 20, 30 years from now, we need to expand that as part of an overall development plan. We haven't got so many dollars into this garage that we couldn't expand that at that site. But, yes, we are trying to stay within the resolution that was established, the range of square footages, and also to meet some of the unmet needs that are currently being met in the current relationship between facilities and law enforcement. Remember that the Sallyport is much larger and meets much more of the operational needs of the Sheriff's Department, but doesn't have vehicle storage there. That, remember, we have that combined in the current facility. This will separate storage and equipment storage and that type of thing in this building and can be added on to or changed in the future because you don't have so many dollars.
So Steve, the answer then is our need for space will increase over time. And I guess that's one of the things that I think we've engaged this debate a few months ago on I think that we had a unanimous decision. The board made a very courageous and very good decision to basically plan for expansion. And we don't ever want to do that, but I think we really need to plan for the future. I think we're cutting ourselves short, and maybe the cost isn't as significant with the garage, but I really think we need to plan for the future. I think it's a lot better to do it now than to have to remodel the garage or expand the garage later. So it may seem insignificant, but I think if we have an opportunity to if we're going to need it eventually, I think we need to look into that. And I also think if we're going to have space that we're not going to use right away, I think we should really consider putting the dive rescue boat there and their equipment. And So I think there's some things that we need to decide on this board before we.
Let me be clear that the space that is not being utilized immediately could not be accessible for dive rescue or anybody, because remember that will be building locked. I'm inventing a term here, but when you build onto the existing receiving and Sallyport, once that's all done, you won't be able to drive in and out of there. It will be space that can eventually be filled off for receiving. That will accommodate some of our storage and eventual build-out for receiving in phase two of this project. We'll take that into account, what you talked about, if we need to relook at the size of the storage building, but we're already at the boundaries of the resolution that authorized staff to continue to work. We're going to see if there's another way to accommodate dive rescue somewhere else, because this is very expensive space downtown. We will come back through the public works and judiciary process when we resolve what we've recommended to dive rescue, see if that meets their needs, and let you deal with that as a policy matter. But again, we're staying within the boundaries of what's already been established by the board, the cap, both dollar amount as well as square footage size, and just with the needs of the county, not including dive rescue, we're at the limits of that in the storage building. So in our interpretation of your policy direction, we would have to look at either a larger budget or a larger square foot, and we're trying to postpone those kinds of decisions and trying to stay within the boundaries and see what we can meet there. If we can accommodate dive rescue somewhere else within the county and still meet their needs, maybe not ideally, but still meet their needs, we don't push ourselves beyond the boundary of what you've already given us authority on.
Thank you, Steve. When will we need to expand our storage facility?
Sometime in the future.
Can you give us? I mean, this is. If we're going to do it, might as well do it right. And I guess at a small cost, and if it takes a special resolution or a special, I just don't understand. Can you give us when? Maybe I should ask the sheriff this question. When will we need more space?
Yep, it's on.
Right now, it looks like the space that is being allotted to us is going to meet the needs that we have right now. We've looked at the vehicles that we have, and there are some that are not going to fit in that space, but we do feel we can make some other accommodations off-site, either at Hillview, or we also have some space allotted to us for vehicle storage up at Lakeview. So we do have some other locations that we can use. As far as what the future brings, it's hard to tell. I mean, we have two ATVs now. We have three boats. We have the rescue vehicle. We have two vans for jail inmate transport. So we have a number of vehicles that do add up, but how many we'll have in the future, right now it's difficult to know. But they all possibly don't need to be stored downtown all either. If we have some off-site, for example, we take the boats up to possibly West Salem during the wintertime and accommodate some extra space downtown. So we'll have to see, but so I don't have an answer for you. It's exactly what we're going to need in the future.
Ray Ebert.
Yes, sir. I understand that when we build the out storage or whatever you want to call it, we're going to use 50 parking spots for the building and about another 50 during construction?
We're going to be using, in the end of construction, we project we're going to lose 50 spaces. That includes the addition, the loading dock area, and the garage.
Okay, because I understand we don't have a real excess of parking spaces at the moment, do we?
Correct.
Well, okay, as I understand, we have our employees purchase these little parking passes, and now there's going to be less places to park, and I understand that they're not allowed to park at meters or something. Is that true?
They're not allowed to park at meters in Lot D, which is the Health and Human Services lot.
Okay, where are we going to put all of these folks?
Well, right now we lease out about 35 spaces a month to public downtown tenants.
So are we going to recall those?
It would be my recommendation to the committee and board to recall those 35, and then there's some other things we can do, like take out some meters that we're not always full at. And I think if we lose 50, we're okay. We go beyond that, and we're pushing it.
Steve?
We've also started to address this with department heads, and we'll bring the board and the Public Works Committee a plan, because it doesn't, as you referenced, it's not just about the 50 spaces we'll lose at the end of construction. It's during staging and construction that we need to figure out some relationship for where employees can park, what their alternatives are, and so we'll continue to work with department heads on developing a plan and a set of recommendations for employees and bring that back to the board. We don't have that developed yet, but later on during the year, we'll have to bring something back, because it's more than just those 50 spots. It's also the transition. Can we shuttle? Can we, you know, figure out other ways to deal with it so that the public still has spaces to park in while the employees are dealing with this transition?
I guess I'd like to see us go forward with our campus plan in conjunction only with the outbuilding part. I think the rest of it we can do, but I think we're going to make a mistake if we don't look at the whole plan rather than take 50 spaces here and build a building, and then if we end up doing something within, I think, Mr. Spropolis, didn't you say 18 to 24 months, something should be done with the end of this building, where the old garage could fall in or something?
We need to continue planning for this building.
I think we're going to make a mistake if we do the outbuilding before we take a look at that entire campus plan. I think the rest of it can go forward, but I think it's a mistake if we don't address that that problem.
Leon Paff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to mention, has you investigated going into partnership with the city on this here? Because the dive and rescue team wants to stay within the city limits of La Crosse, because that's where most of it is used in anyway, they may have space, and besides, it wouldn't hurt if the city was in on this, because that's where the dive and rescue team are used out of most of the time.
Andrea Richmond, do you have any answer on, does the city have any space like Isle of Plume or anything?
I know that I brought that up at the Public Works meeting at 4 o'clock, that possibly working with the city, and I know Mr. Spiropoulos was going to check with them as well. So it's going to be discussed. I know Mr. O'Malley had mentioned that too. So thank you.
Okay. Jay, anything to add on that? Okay. John Menninger.
Just a clarification, Sheriff. I saw the article in the paper too. The dive and rescue team is volunteers, right? Not to diminish them. But in addition to that, we have the Sheriff's Patrol. And then in addition to that, we have the La Crosse Fire Department, and they have a couple of boats that they can put out on the water too. Is the dive and rescue team a volunteer organization?
Yes. Yes, they are. They're
not to diminish it, but...
They are volunteer, and they... And they also do the diving, which I don't believe the La Crosse Fire Department does.
I think they do some with their hazardous materials training, but again, it's nice to have all these things, but this is, just to put it in context, it is a volunteer organization, if I'm not incorrect.
It is volunteer.
Mr. Bina, did you have your hand up?
Well, I just, prior to our building, you know, 10 years ago, if you remember back, some of you remember back that far, before we started construction on the jail, the DNR was bound and determined that we were building on land that was polluted because the old, what is it, that used to sit across the street? No, it wasn't Bonnie Armory Ward. Northern Engraving used to be across the street, and they were bound and determined that this land was polluted. And we had to run three separate tests because they didn't believe the first two. So before you start building, you better make sure you get the clearance from DNR that the land is clean, and it was over here, because they didn't think it was. So you need to do that and not hold up the first construction by getting into a mess with DNR.
Any other questions? Okay.
The next... portion of the project is a separate little package of housing renovation, which we want to do before we start on the main building. This will enable the sheriff to bring the female offenders over from the jail across the street and bring in the resources of the staff so that they're all in one spot and he can better utilize the staff in the new building. So what we're looking at here is renovating the existing second floor. I think we mentioned this in the last time around, but this upper quadrant of the housing pod on the second floor, what we're proposing to do is a new wall dividing the D pod into two separate little divisions so that the Sheriff's Department can better segregate the different populations of people, and they can be appointed a little differently so that they can have the most serious offenders in single cells in this pod down in the, it's called the B pod. And we're running a corridor through here. So once we're doing the renovation, this will be the renovation for this portion of the building from now through the completion of the project. And this ties in with the new addition, because this is where we'd be tying in. So we're looking at doing this as a separate package, finishing the drawings in March, and sending it out for bids as soon as we can after that. So
what's your best guess as to when the females would actually be moved over?
I'll get to that in a second here. I think I have a slide on the schedule.
Okay.
This is the what it would look like. This is a modeling program that we use in the design. We actually create a 3D model. We don't just draw a two-dimensional blueprint like we used to. But this is what the view from the sheriff's existing control room would be. You can see into some of the pods that are there. You can see through the windows and into the cell doors way behind there. This is just to help visualize what it looks like, and you can see the visions are fairly clean, and we're trying to improve the vision, less hollow metal, less blocks, and more glass. So this is to help the sheriff. And the schedule that was the question was brought up, we're looking at design ending in the end of March, and we'd like to bid it in April, and the bid opening in April 22nd or around there. construction would be April through August, and then occupancy would be September. And that would be right about when we're starting to get the bids out for the main building. So you can see we're almost done by the time we're getting the other one out for bids. So we don't want the main building to slow this one down. Yes? The women would be in that quadrant, any one of those four pods, and it depends on the population and how they want to divide them up. They could be in all four, or they could be in two of the four, or maybe the sheriff has a better answer than I do.
No, it all depends on the numbers, of course, and how low we can get those numbers. But, yeah, well, that was our thought, was those four pods that we're dividing up would be probably a good place if we don't have too many women. If the numbers get higher, we may have to look at occupying one of the blocks that are currently occupied by the men.
So you sort of would have floating populations, say you end up with more women, then they go in with the single cells, or?
All right, as I see it, we probably may not designate certain cells or certain blocks, say this is a female or this is a male. It all depends on the population, and if we needed more space, we'd expand into other areas, and if we didn't need as much space, then possibly we could combine them all into one or two blocks, and the men could use the other blocks that were being used by females. And if it's all dependent on the population and how low that population remains.
Would they be able to see each other?
Between the blocks, they would not be able to.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Redpath.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve O'Malley, this question's for you. In regards to the bidding on April 22nd, design by March 27th, when are we going to make a decision on if the building's going to be green or not? The green design, construction.
That won't affect the storage building necessarily, or the remodeling. That'll be a separate decision. But we're expecting probably to bring you data and payback information probably about the same timeline as we get into the next stages, probably in April.
Any other questions? Now for the main addition and renovation, this is the major portion of the work. We'll go through the different floor plans and then let you look at a model of the building. On the site, it's the major filling out the rest of the block to the west. And what we're looking at, I apologize for the graphics here, it's a little washed out, but we're getting into the working drawings of what we actually plan when we design it. So what we're looking at is down the middle, the existing building is off to the right, and the new addition is off to the left, with the sally port and the justice sanctions and booking and the kitchen laundry on the northwest corner. So that's pretty much a very busy floor plan. This is where we spend almost half of our time in planning this out, because this has to work. This has to be operationally efficient. And we're spending a lot of money on this floor making it work. We just want to make sure that it meets the sheriff's, and we do graphics, and we'll show you some of the pictures and what they look like. And we're trying to make sure that the sheriff's department staff knows what they're getting, knows how it's going to operate. If it changes some operations to make it more efficient, we need to make sure that that's all worked into this plan. The next floor up, as this is being developed, this shell space to the northwest corner, we have a training center for the sheriff. This is right off of their classroom that they have, or their training room they have now. So it's a training space for mat room and the things where they need a bigger space, where they have sort of like wrestling mats on the floor and the walls, and they can do more tactical training there. It's a pretty rough room, and it would just be a simple room and for training. The little boxes off to the left here is a community corrections or probation parole. It would be two of their departments, or the two of their divisions, combined into this one spot. And we've worked with them on the program size. It's about a little over 11,000 square feet of space that they would lease from the county. The space to the lower left-hand corner is empty shell space. And then we put in some classroom or training spaces that we moved up from the lower level. This would be used by justice sanctions for classes. It could also be used by probation parole and any other county agencies. So that's really a public space in there. It's a general use classrooms. The space in the middle is for fans and mechanical equipment. On the second floor, this is the, I think you've seen this before, but it's just a better development of the space. We're looking at the two direct supervision pods, one on the north and one on the south, and then the two rec areas that are coming along real well. So there's a lot of daylight. We're trying to bring the daylight through the rec area, so there's a glass wall on the outside, a glass wall separating the rec area from the day room, and then individual cells along the north, and then the south on the south pod. And you can see on this one, if I can get this working, there it is. This is the renovation I was just talking about before. You can see how it all ties together there.
Ray Ebert?
Yes, sir. If you could go back to the probation and parole one. I think there's one back.
Can I go backwards?
There it is. If I remember correctly, originally that was out to the south part of the building. Is that correct?
We're looking at that as a... We looked at that, and we did talk about that at one time. We had it in the southwest corner. But in order to plan for the future, as you know, our concern is that we thought that stairs off to the left there is a good way to expand justice sanctions. If we need to bring them up and give them more space as they grow, they could take that southwest corner and just continue to grow up that way if we needed to.
Because I would just think that if the shelled space is all together, that gives us more flexibility down the road rather than now it's broke up and we can't combine it. I'm not convinced that that's one of your better ideas.
Originally, when you saw this plan, when they were out to the front, we were projecting X amount of square feet for them. They've since given us the number that they need. And I believe this is 12,000 square feet.
Yeah, it's a little less than 12, yeah.
So they would actually be on both sides of that hallway. So their space would have been split. So this makes a much better fit by putting them in the middle like that.
Well, it may be a much better fit for them, but doesn't it take away flexibility for us? It always say, I know with property, two contiguous pieces better than two split pieces, and I would assume that that's got to be relatively true with a building.
As Paul mentioned, it's our opinion that if justice sanctions needs to expand, we could easily finish off the shelled space that's just above them as opposed to moving probation twice. So it seemed to make sense that justice sanctions has sufficient space for the near term, the next 5 to 10 years in their current location. If in the future that continued to expand, we at least would have empty shell space just above them.
What's the square footage for justice sanctions downstairs now?
It's about 6,700 square feet, 6,900, something like that.
Okay, thank you.
If you've moved the community corrections to the north, you can see that stairs that comes down from the housing pod above, it's sort of in the middle, and it's a natural barrier that we have to live with from a separation of the area. So the community corrections wouldn't fit to the north, but it could probably slide to the south if you needed to. But
Jill Billings?
Could you please, with your laser, show me how staff will enter the building and get through the metal detectors and get to where they're going to be?
The main entry to the courthouse is right in this first level, sort of halfway between the lower floor, the ground floor, and the first floor. And so we would propose that all people come in into the building through this, go through the metal detector. And if they need to go down to the jail, they come down a ramp. This is two levels of a ramp. It's about 5 feet down. And so you go down that little rampway, and it's an open walkway, open concourse, if you want to call it that. But they come down here, and then they go either... Now you're down a level, so I have to go back to the other plan, but you're down a level. And if you want to come up on the first floor, you come up these steps like you go to the clerk of courts, and we created a hallway on the first floor that gets you into... probation, parole, justice sanction, or not justice sanction, but probation, parole on this first floor or the classrooms.
So will the only way into the building be that one set of doors on the southeast?
Then we have a second set of doors that we're adding here, but we don't want to play it up because we want everybody to go through the metal detector on the first floor on the southeast corner. Yes, that's... It's not the only way, but it's the only way for the public.
On busy court days, aren't you going to have a congestion issue right there? I'm thinking of jury selection days, small claims days, child support calendar days.
That was my
question. Sometimes we get a huge influx of people at all about the same time.
That's what I'm wondering, if you've done any studies of who will be using the building and if the detectors that we have now will be enough or if we'll have to add anything there.
In the future, we may have to add one, but at this time, we don't feel we're going to have to. The lobby space isn't going to change in size of where it currently is. So we'll still have the same amount of staging area. It's just that everyone will actually come in from the east side of the building, southeast side, those four doors that go across the lobby, and stage within the lobby there then. So it really won't affect screening down in the lobby that we can see.
Well, will you move the metal detectors then further west?
Probably not. We'll just line people through and come in that way. They come in both doors now. The majority of them come in the east doors.
Right, but then they can kind of go off toward the west.
It'll be roped off to get down to that ramp so that you can't go from the east doors directly through down to the ramp.
Okay, well, so good luck.
also recognize that the planning has been concentrating on justice sanctions and jail staff so far. We have not yet met with other courthouse staff to actually walk through some of these things. This is very preliminary. So recognize all these concerns are things we will ask and get feedback from clerk of courts, from DA staff, from the judges as we keep going through this process. So one of the advantages is you're at least seeing at ground level the kinds of things we've been concentrating on. Also, the sheriff, of course, hasn't signed off on any of the details here. We're still working at it, but we thought it was an opportunity to bring you up to date on exactly where we're at, how we see it fitting now. We may not have solved everything, and there are other issues that will keep coming up as you review it, as well as the people that work in the courthouse review it right now.
We do talk to the security staff that's there as we go in and out, and we say, what's it like if you added more people, and would you add another metal detector? And they don't see adding a package pass at all, but it's mostly you might have two metal detectors that you walk through, and so they said they could speed up the process that way. So.
Jill Billings.
Isn't there ability, Sheriff, for staff to come in a separate door? Would we want to do something like that with?
I think all the courthouse staff or law enforcement center staff uses that south-facing door, with the exception of some of the sheriff's department staff can use that back door entrance to the sheriff's department, and then the dispatch center can use the west door on that south or northwest corner to enter the dispatch center. I believe everyone else comes in through that south entrance.
So all the sheriff staff would still come in this door on the north here. And dispatch could come in that door, or there's another door on this level here. Second floor housing. Any questions on the housing itself? Capacities are the same. We're just improving the relationships and working out the details of the different functions in the day room and the spaces there. And it's pretty much, I think we're pretty close to being approvable by Department of Corrections. Every time we meet with the sheriff, we also invite the State Department of Corrections jail inspector. So he's actively involved, more so than I've seen in any of my other projects, in helping, through the process and giving his guidance and his wisdom for his years of inspecting jails in this area. So any comments you have to say about that, Sheriff? Or?
No, he's been very helpful, and I know that he has commented on the design of the direct housing pods. Is he feels that from what he's seen in Wisconsin, it's the best design that he's seen, and he's from his perspective is very pleased with the design as well as the program space and the recreation space, and as Paul will get into here, the amount of light that looks like we're going to be able to bring into that those two indirect housing units. So from his perspective so far, as he's been very pleased with what we've been able to accomplish.
One of the concerns has been, even from the CARE report on, and the jail inspector also, is that we have program spaces. And what we've done is we've even added another program space in the corner there. It's a little taking out a inefficiently used corner and making it a classroom. So it's a smaller classroom. It can have maybe 10 people in there at one time. But it's a lot of daylight. We're going to get daylight from the outside. It'll be a real nice room, a two-story space. And then we have program room on this side, and we have two more program rooms on the other side. So there's plenty of program in addition to the two rec areas. So from a type of appointments or things that are adjacent to the pod, and all these are accessible without leaving the pod itself. So that was the third floor, but this is a section through the building. It's hard to see, but the dark lines are the floor lines, and then that's just the profile of the building. You can sort of see the little housing, the cells on top of each other, and the stairs, and those are the day rooms. So it just gives you a section of what the building looks like. Now, some interior perspectives. This is, comes out of our computer program. This would be the booking with just a ceiling and the receiving cells. Some other ones, I'll go through these quickly. This is the view from booking out to the receiving cells. And I think as I look at this with the sheriff, I'm critical of my own concepts in our preliminary stage, but that's too high. I'd cut that off so that you can see over the top and get a better view. And that's the purpose of these CAD drawings, is the 3D modeling, is that you can actually see what you're getting, and you don't have to wait till it gets built to say, well, that's too high, I can't see over that. So it helps us communicate between the sheriff's department and the architect. Some other views. This is from central control. This is looking into booking. They're pretty white. This is the a perspective of the day room. You can see it's a real tall space. It gives you a feeling of what it's going to be like. Mostly just furniture in an open day room with a tall ceiling and the cell doors. And the control officer would be right in the middle in that little desk there as a control, the direct supervision person. Similar furniture would be a detention grade furniture. That's looking at the recreation. So now you can see the glass wall between the day room and the rec area. It'll be all heavy duty detention glass so that you can't break it with a basketball or anything. And then the wall behind it, you can sort of see, you can get more daylight to the outside. Again, more of the same type of thing. Just giving you a perspective of what the space will look like when you're done. The schedule for this, Don?
All right. Thank you, Paul. Thank you. I'll go through the schedule real quick. It really hasn't changed before Val gets up and wows you with the elevations. But this would be the schedule just for the addition and the renovation. And after the comments on the garage, I think we'll look at that a little bit more before we start that. But as far as the addition, we're through the schematic design now. So we're in the process, Mike from our office and back and forth with Potter, we're going through redoing the budget, trying to take some pieces off where we actually can. Hopefully by the meeting towards the end of February, we'll be able to come back, give you a little bit more of an update on the budget. Design development will start now and will run through April. Construction documents will be put together from May to July. We plan to bid it in August, and we'd like to start the addition in September of 08, have the addition portion completed by December of 09, leave about a month for the commissioning and the shakedown, the training for the sheriff, get them moved in February of 2010, and then go in and complete the renovation on the ground floor of the existing jail. They only gave me one slide. I don't know if you have any questions or not. They said I have a problem with the buttons, so. But this is pretty much the same schedule we looked at last time, just different format.
Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Let Val wow.
Okay. I have a problem with the buttons, and I have three slides. I'm going to let you take care of the buttons. I have my own pointer. This building is definitely designed from the inside out. As Paul shared with you, with in-depth study with staff, it really, that's what's where this whole plan started. What I'm going to show you tonight is an initial view of what it could look like on the outside. One of the things that we inherited with this is the existing building. And the existing building, as do all buildings, sort of have a vocabulary. And your particular building right now has a vocabulary of its own, plus it sits into a campus setting with other buildings in it. This building has a two-color stones, has a reflective glass, has what we call ribbon windows, and it also has curtain wall on it. And the two brick colors, the dark and the light, become part of it. One of the issues as we sat down to do this building and to come up with a suitable addition was, how do we do it? Do we make it look like it is, like it looks like right now, so it doesn't even look like an addition, so it's what we would call a seamless addition? Do we make it look a little bit different and update it, or do we go somewhere in between? As we talked to the committee, interestingly enough, of the committee we were working with, the range of answers to that question ranged from new to make it the same. And what I'm going to show you tonight are three images that try and, I wasn't trying to compromise that comment, but I was trying to get it so that it tied to the existing building, but also spoke to some of the other buildings on the campus, particularly the one directly across the street and some of the downtown context that's there. This first image, you can begin to see right off, right in this area, here's the existing building. This is where your canopy is now, but I'd kind of like you to focus on this. My window has looked out on this south elevation for the last 25 years, so I have looked at this building since it was built from that side. You're used to seeing the building from the east side as you come out. I don't see that side all the time, so I see the brick, the dark brick, and some of that. What we've done with the addition is one of the other challenges, and Paul touched on it. We have a major entrance here, and we have a subordinate entrance here, which is really done for after-hours access. When you park in this parking lot, we hope that there will be a strong emphasis to this this canopy so that we don't have to have a sign that says, enter here. We want the building to speak clearly of where to enter it. And in this case, we've taken that canopy that's there now. I am trying to hold this still, but it's the distance. And we've extended it a little bit, and we've resheathed it to tie into what's going on. This part of the building here really doesn't change. This is what we've added on. And you can see that what we've done, and you'll get a better image of this in the next two slides, is we have used the red brick as the central brick color, and then we haven't used the tan brick, but we've used the precast, which is on this canopy right now. It's actually part of this bell pedestal, too. And we've used that color to mark the entrances, and that's what you're going to see marked here. Paul, could we just go to the next one? Here's looking now, we're looking from the southwest, looking northeast, and you can see the original building up here, and here's the addition. This is that canopy we're trying to tie into. This is the ramp inside that goes down, and here's this smaller entrance, and you can see it literally extends behind that screen out to the front and to the other, and just by its sheer size, we're hoping that that'll help speak. We also have deliberately gotten away from the idea of the ribbon windows that are on the building. We've tried to combine it with ribbon windows as well as what we call punched window openings, which you find downtown, and you also find in the building to the east, your existing building, which is called, what do you call it? Health and Service Building. And so we've tried to take this vocabulary and tried to stretch it a bit. You also will begin to pick up on this west side. We have used this element to mark the entrance to the Sally Port, and you're also going to see it to mark the service entrance to the building. So, not yet, but it just gives you an idea. You can also just make out there's the big window panel that goes into the rec area. So we're actually modulating the window sizes. We're not being slave to that ribbon window that to us has a security feeling. We're trying to get it away from that security sense. Remember that we can do that because we have that service corridor that runs between the cells and the outside wall that lets us play with this wall and open it up a little bit and still have the security grill right behind it. So we're not directly tied to that issue. Now, Paul, there we go. This is coming now down 3rd Street. You're getting a view kind of to the southeast.
This is looking at this, the side of the building that really would be the service side of the building. And you can begin to see the loading dock area underneath this piece right here. And we've screened off the refuse containers and things like this, trying to get this building to have a... It doesn't have a front and a back. It literally is visible in an urban setting in this context on all four sides. So we're trying to get this so it works all four directions. But you can also see the decision to use the redder, dark, the red-brown brick instead of the tan brick that's very predominant on the east side, and we've used that as the item and used a lighter color to come around. What I don't have ready for tonight is we actually are doing an image of this. It's running right now. It won't be ready till tomorrow's meeting with the committee, but we are going to step back and look at the garage in this. We want the garage that Paul showed tonight that is in concrete block, but it's colored. It's trying to use these two color patterns and doing it in panels, and we're trying to make it so that it's part of this family. It's not this quality of construction, but we've tried to use some of the vocabulary of the punched windows, a little bit of the masonry color, even doing it with just concrete block and using that same motif. You'll have a better example of this because we're going to step further to the north and look back at it and see it in that setting, and we'll bring that back to you. But this does give you a little, you can almost see on the west side here, this is those windows, that big window opening that looks into the rec area or the program area off of that those two cell areas. Questions? This is sort of an initial view just to give you some idea of what it could be.
Questions for Val? Margaret, what?
On the right, are there four stories and no basement?
Yes.
And on the left, as we go up that incline, is there an underground level there that we just don't see? I mean, I really don't know the guts of this building. So.
Yeah, well, but you do bring up this. We're down almost a full story from 4th Street to 3rd Street. So 3rd Street, we do have more of this open. By the time we get to 4th Street, only a little bit of it is poking out of the ground. So that's what that transition. As Paul was trying to describe the floor plans, you have to almost know the nomenclature. We're calling this ground floor, this level here, ground, and the first floor is here, second, third. So it's really, depending on when we're saying first floor, we're referring to the one that's on the sidewalk on 4th Street coming straight across. Ground is what you would call the basement level. So you're really homing into an issue that's really critical to this scheme, and it does change it. Does that sort of affirm your... Okay.
Tara Johnson.
So can we stay on that slide, and can you, with the laser, just... ballpark show where the garage, where the storage building will be?
It's actually going to be right here.
Okay.
These are these parking spaces that we were talking about early. It's about right here, the front, and it'll be right in this area. So if I can come back a little bit further on 3rd Street to the north, we'll be able to get that view in there and see it so you can see it in context.
Thank you.
John Miniger.
Just there's two parking lots on that north end. There's the one right next to this building across the street that's got the meters, and then there's this bigger one where the garage is going to be. I see you got some trees coming down between them. Is that going to be kind of like a, what for lack of a better word, a soft area where people can sit and have lunch, or is it going to be nice and user-friendly, or...
There's a little bit of grass area there. I'm going to tell you that to get our parking spaces in there, what we've done is we've maxed out the parking as much as we could, but we've also left some green areas that in the winter is a place to pile snow, and during the summer months it is a place that you could have some tables set out there. But it's not a park-like setting. I mean, it's literally parking with trying to get some green space in that area. And it occurs right off of the north face of the building because that used to be the street right away, and we can't build there. So we have utilities below there. So it's kind of reserved for parking or something without footings.
Yeah, right. Just as a follow-up, and a lot of people aren't, I don't even know if it's a dedicated park, and of course I was mayor for 8 years, I ought to know, but just to the east of City Hall, and actually it's right on the corner of 7th and La Crosse Street, there's that kind of little area there that's there's some trees and some benches and some concrete, like, left over from, what, the old courthouse or something, you know? Yeah. It's a nice little pocket park.
Yep.
And it really is attractive. Right across where Gideon Hickson is there, you know? Right.
Yeah. I think, yeah, that is. We call them a vest pocket park. The only liability to this one, in my mind, would be its north face. It'd be nice to have a place where we had south sun and be able to heat it and stuff, even in the summer. But in this case, it will be in shade, but it will have some. It could have some similarities to that. The difference is, I have a feeling in the winter we'll have snow piled up in it, unlike the one on the east side of City Hall.
But to follow up on John's point, and we've talked about this before, where your initial view of downtown is going to be.
Yep.
This.
Yeah.
And I think making it as soft as possible in some sort of pocket park type of thing, if there's any way to do that, I think would be important. I mean, other than Burger King, this is what you see.
And actually, just to, this was in committee.
Oh, and the La Crosse Tribune building, I'm sorry.
In committee, John Menninger's comment and one of his questions as we were doing this, and actually saw this image before we put the trees on it and actually looked at this whole thing, was to remind the design committee, the design team, that this is our front door coming south and coming from the north, going south into town. So he reinforced that look. Because initially we were showing it from the south a lot, and we weren't seeing that balance between the two. So it did help to direct the design team.
Jeff Schrader.
Can you point out to me Central Dispatch there?
It would be right there.
All right. Did you put any provisions in there to secure that area?
To secure it more than it is now?
Right. It's just glass there.
Right now, the west side, obviously, we're building a building that's secure, but the only part that's left is the north windows, and we're really not doing anything at this time to make it any more secure than it is. We could, but right now we haven't looked at it. We've talked about, we did have a meeting with dispatch, and we talked about their needs. And as we're a couple of the court services is moving out of that area into the secure portion of the first floor, so they're having more space and dispatch, but nothing was mentioned about more security in the windows.
I just thought that there was some talk about that when this renovation was going to take place, and it still really concerns me that somebody could put everything out of commission right there.
Well, we did talk about an entry for law enforcement to park there. We even talked about dedicating one parking stall so they can still pull up and come in the door and walk right in on that north side there if they want. But nothing was mentioned about glass or bars or screens.
You do remember correctly, Jeff, that was a discussion some time ago, and that probably should be a discussion that is had again just to make sure that is covered. Ralph Geary.
Thank you. How many parking spots are we going to have after construction? After the project's complete, how many county parking spots off street are we going to have?
I don't have an answer for that.
Is it 50 less than we currently have?
Yeah.
50 less than the current number.
Okay, it's that simple.
Was that building on the addition?
That's.
Yes.
Yeah. Other questions? Joe Bill Skemper.
How do we replace those 50 lost spaces then? Now, I'm going to piggyback a question. We currently lease parking space to people in that parking lot, right?
35 of them.
Okay. Are we going to keep those permits or what? Just enlighten me.
Right now we lease about 35 spaces in Lot C, which is the full square block lot on the south side of the building. So that would be part of that equation of where do we eliminate parking.
Does that mean we are eliminating those parking leases?
That'll be a committee county board decision.
Okay, thank you.
Jim Burns.
question. Are there any sheriff department vehicles that are going to be in the garage that are currently out in our parking spot, so essentially we're not losing any parking with those sheriff vehicles? Does that, my question, make sense?
We think that we'll be able to park most of those. We think we'll be able to park most of those vehicles in the garage, so we have very few of any.
Oh, it's red. We think that we'll be able to park some of those vehicles that right now are sitting outside in the garage. Also, with the cohort allowing us to have those extra vehicles, so we have shift cars, hopefully there'll be less cars that'll need to sit in the parking lot because they'll be used more efficiently rather than sitting there. So right now we think that it's going to probably work out to our benefit, and we won't have that many vehicles parked outside as we do currently.
So it'll free up essentially 10 or 20 spaces?
Well, I don't think we have that many out there.
Oh. It'll free up a few.
It'll free up a few.
Okay.
It'll be a few.
We're going to lose 50 permanently. How many are we going to lose during construction?
Possibly another 50.
Okay. That's when it's going to be real fun.
Yep.
Okay. Other questions? Tara Johnson.
Just while we're beating parking spots to death here, what's the revenue from those 35 leased spots?
$30 a month per spot.
Thank you.
I can't do that quick. One thing that
Where's
I wanted,
Gary when you need him, huh?
One thing that I did want to mention, though, the days that we are short on parking is jury selection days. And those are a Monday. They're 3-4 times a year, maybe. Well, they're more than that. But we could have upwards to 100 jurors come in for jury selection. That's when we get real short. Any other day, we'd have 50 extra spots in the lots with no problem.
So. Other questions? Okay. That it for you guys?
That's it.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we're going to go on to the comp plan stuff. A couple things I want to mention. Everybody has this handout, right? Oops. Hey, you guys, you didn't talk about sustainability. Thank you, Maureen.
Sorry about that. We don't have a slide for sustainability. We're working currently with Mark and Johnson in itemizing that list that we went through at one of the previous meetings. We're going through all of the comments on there, and we're going to come back with a budget that says, for this item, we think the additional cost to the county would be X dollars, and it'll be an allowance or a budget or an actual cost. Sometimes some things we have quotes for, some things will be an allowance. And we'll also have a payback. If there is a payback, we'll say it's going to be payback in 5 years or 15 years. And with that, we would come back to the board with the final sort of a spreadsheet tally that says, this is what the cost would be. This is the payback for these items. Do you want to do it? And we're not quite ready yet because a lot of these things are sort of fuzzy, and we're not sure exactly what. We have meetings with the engineers coming up. We're going to go through in detail with them, and we'll come back to you with a more specific recommendation.
Tom Rauch.
Then just a follow-up question. From your description, it doesn't sound like that this is going to be presented to the committee tomorrow.
No.
And what kind of a schedule do you picture having that discussion? Is that in 2 weeks or in 4 weeks?
We have a meeting with the engineers and facilities in 2 weeks here, and that will be giving us more guidance as far as what kind of systems you're looking for, and I'm going to say probably a few weeks after that.
Okay, because the decision about going for LEED certification or not, it's my understanding that it will be made, that decision will be made by this entire board at one of its
Correct.
Events here, so not just by the committee itself.
Correct.
Thank you.
Don Dina.
I guess I do have a question, and you probably can't answer it. Maybe you can, I don't know, but I ran into one of my constituents today from my adjoining district, and the word was that there was somebody was getting price quotes on carpeting.
Correct.
And I understand there was some interest in bringing some carpeting over here from Great Britain at $38 a square yard. And the question he posed to me, where are we going to use that high-priced carpeting? And I thought I'd ask, as long as it came up to me, I didn't have an answer.
That's the county seal in the county administrator's office.
He said, what kind of a jail are you building here? I couldn't afford it in my house, and the hotels can't afford it, so...
I'll answer maybe for Mark and Johnson. Mark and Johnson is getting prices on different products that we're specifying or we're looking at specifying, and we haven't really specified any specific carpet yet, so it's hard to say what carpet there is we're looking at. We are looking at some high abuse carpet in the day rooms to make them softer and more acoustically tolerable. But other than that, I don't have any exotic carpeting from where? Great Britain?
It's coming over from Britain because they're the only ones that can handle this type of carpeting. And I thought I would ask. And I hope we don't have an RFP on that.
Yeah, we'll have 8 or 9 newspaper stories about it, too.
Under the LEED certification points or an incentive is to keep everything local. So that'll be an incentive to get as much local as we can.
All right.
So... we do look for recycled material in carpeting, but that's pretty common now in these. So,
any other questions? Okay, thank you. All right, comp plan. You have this on your desks. This is what we'll be voting on. We wanted to hand it out tonight. You've seen earlier versions of this. Members of the committee have seen the final version of it. These are in black and white because the color copies were $25 a piece, or 40. Oh, so if you absolutely have to see it in color, you're going to have to come over here and take a look at it. Up in Charlie's office, I assume you'd be able to see it, or Marion has a color copy, but otherwise you have a black and white copy. What we're going to do tonight is Tara's going to lead this discussion. If there are proposals that people have to make modifications to the comp plan, you can make those motions tonight or you can make suggestions tonight, however you choose to. If it's something that you think the board should vote on tonight, that's fine. If you think you want people to give something to chew on and think about between now and when we're taking a vote, that's fine too. But we will not be taking a final vote tonight on the comp plan. You have some comments from some of the towns that they had sent in. We told them, you know, we were not voting on it until later, and so there could still be more comments that come in. But we certainly want to try to get as much stuff out tonight for people to think about. If you want to send things in a different direction or whatever, you'd be well advised not to wait till the night that we're voting on it to say, oh, now I propose such and such. Give some thought to it and you know, throw it out there now so that people can give themselves a little bit of thought about it, too. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tara Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the privileges of chairing the Comprehensive Plan Steering Committee for the past 30 months has been the opportunity to work with some pretty terrific people. And I wanted to take tonight as the official launch of our ending of this process. I want to take a couple minutes to acknowledge those folks, and I want to start with our extraordinary staff person, our planner, Charlie Handy, who's going to probably keep his head down like that and pretend like he doesn't hear what I'm saying. Charlie is a very patient, tenacious, and knowledgeable professional who, in case you haven't picked up on this on your own, is very passionate about planning. And he took a group of us, some of whom knew quite a bit about planning and land use issues, most of us who didn't know much about it, and taught us our job and led us through a very thorough but sometimes challenging process. And so I wanted to publicly acknowledge Charlie and his work. So thank you, Charlie, on behalf of everybody. And to...
So now there are at least two women in this world that think you're passionate, Charlie. That's great.
Moving right along to Jeff and Mike and Carl and the other county staff folks who had Charlie's back when he didn't want them to have his back and when he didn't think he needed them to have his back. We acknowledge them also. They were tremendous resources to us throughout the process. And the folks at Schreiber Anderson. We started with Nick Lelak. We moved on to Kevin. We moved on to Reed, and they had coworkers, Abby, Bob, Rudd from Rudd Consulting. They were terrific consultants to work with, and they were with us every step of the way as well, and we want to acknowledge their work. And most especially, I want to take this opportunity to publicly acknowledge the steering committee members. Some of them are sitting in this room right now. The county board supervisors who served on the Comprehensive Plan Steering Committee include Jill Billings, Don Bina, Vicki Burke, Terry Hansen, Tom Rauch, and Jeff Schrader. And the citizen members, remember we tried to have a very diverse group of interests represented on the steering committee. We divided the county geographically. We pulled people from throughout the county. And the citizen members were very important to that mix for us. The co-chair was Audrey Cotter, Don Frank from the town of Shelby, Paul Kitzman from the town of Burns, Eve Zellmer from the Builders Association and from the town of Hamilton, Steve Kuyak from the town of Onalaska, Paul Amborn from the village of Bangor, and Charlie Weath from the city of La Crosse. That group of individuals stuck with this process. They signed up for it. They stuck with it. And after about 30 months or so, we present to you officially the plan that we have produced for your consideration. Those committee members not only met at least monthly, but read hundreds and hundreds of pages of data and information. And for some of us, okay, just for me, I had to read it twice or three or four times in some cases, especially early on in the process, to really understand some of the complexities of the information. We had 30-plus public meetings. We estimate between 750 and 800 people attended those public hearings. We surveyed the county and read through those surveys. There has been a great deal of work that has been put into this process. And the legislation that the state passed in 2001-2 that called for smart growth, what year was that, Charlie?
It was in the
Budget Bill of 02, Charlie says. The state mandated smart growth, and they further mandated that municipalities and counties had to develop comprehensive plans and that future zoning decisions would be guided by consistent interpretation of those comprehensive plans. So we were told to do planning. And it seems to me as we consider the documents that we have in front of us in approving La Crosse County's comprehensive plan, we really have to ask ourselves two questions. One is, do we think we should plan? And I believe that we've really already answered that question. We did it back in May of 05 when we authorized the preparation of the comprehensive plan, and we hired Schreiber Anderson as our consultants. We reaffirmed our commitment to do planning every time the steering committee brought forth a new element or portion of the plan. So that was the public participation plan in June of 05, the issues, vision, and goals in July of 06, the approval of the land use element in June of 07. And so collectively, through our votes on those items that have come before us as a county board, we have answered the question, yes, we should plan. And that has been the work of the Comprehensive Plan Steering Committee for these 30 months. So now really the question that we have left to answer tonight is this a good plan? And I want to reinforce what Chairman Doyle said, that the ordinance that you have in front of you, 149 pages or some such amount, is the codified indexed version of what we all got December 10th at the public hearing up at the Omni Center. So we've had this version of it since December. You've had all of the component parts as they were approved throughout the process. And the ordinance version is for consistency's sake and to make Bill Shepard happy. Somehow I thought that would get a bigger chuckle, darn. But really, these two versions say the same thing. They just say them in different ways. So the ordinance that you have makes it maybe a little bit easier for some of us to read. And so back to this question of, is this a good plan, what you have in front of you? What you have is the best work of the steering committee and what we were able to develop with significant public input and a very thorough, sometimes exciting debates and discussion-filled process, but a very thorough and deliberative process. And so I hope that what we do in the rest of our discussion this evening and through the process of approving this at our March board meeting continues that very thorough and deliberative approach. If you think that the plan can be improved, then I'm hoping that you came prepared tonight with amendments to the plan and amendments that you think will improve the plan. If at all possible, I implore you, please make those amendments tonight so that we can all consider them and so that your colleagues have time to review them in advance of the vote that we will take next month. And I implore all of us to come prepared to vote at our March meeting so that this county board that has been working on this plan throughout its long, thorough, deliberative process is the county board that votes on La Crosse County's comprehensive plan. And I think Charlie has a couple of additional comments.
Just for really brief clarification, we did, in the process of codifying this, make some corrections. And that's they weren't changes. We did not make any changes to the verbiage in this document other than a correction of one date said that the transit center would be built in 2006. Obviously, that's not correct, so we corrected that to say 2008. Other corrections, Teresa Schnitzler went through very thoroughly and found some corrections for us to fix Western Technical College versus Western Wisconsin Technical College. So those are the changes that were made in the codified version. The only other changes in the codified version is the headings are the same. They just are organized under a outline format that fits with the outline format of our ordinances. So none of the documentation has been changed. So it's really just some minor corrections that have been made.
Okay, questions of Charlie before we start debate. Brad Paff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charlie and Tara, I want to compliment you on an awful lot of work here. I especially like the demographics. As a social scientist, I like to study demographics. But a question I have for you, looking at the La Crosse County median value and value of owner-occupied units as of 2000, and it states that you know the value of these homes, as we all know, in the last 8 years, the values of these homes have grown exponentially. And so I'm just wondering, is there some way we can get more recent data than looking at the Bureau of Census 2000, if we could get it from the Builders Association or the Realtors or anything that demonstrate the values of these homes have gone up
the best, quite a bit. The best way to improve that information is the 2010 census, because the census information is really the information that gives us most of the other demographics. So if we use the Builders Association data, it would be skewed in one way, one form or another, And the state of Wisconsin does not do projections as far as that goes. So we wanted to make sure that we didn't use a special interest group data. We used the census data. And so the only way to accurately get the next round is when we get the 2010 census data back. And so the idea is to get that stuff back as quickly as possible. That's why we're involved with the LUCA process to try and improve that 2010 census.
Second question is, Tara stated the other people that served on this, you have worked with other units of government, correct?
Yes.
Great. And you have worked with school districts?
Yes.
You are aware, then, that the state school aid formula is absolutely antiquated. It's way behind. And you are aware, then, that school districts are penalized if they grow when it comes to state aid, and they're penalized if they decrease in population?
Well, that's not completely accurate. If they grow in their student population, but part of that DPI formula is the average wage. Part of that DPI formula is some other demographic data for that school district. Right. And so there are school districts that can grow in population and actually receive higher aid formulas based on some of those other demographics. So I would agree with you that DPI formula is difficult at times to work with and difficult at many times even for a statistician to understand where the formulas are going and coming from. But they can, in certain situations, actually increase their aid per student even with an increasing population.
And I'm still going through to look at the demographics, the data you have, excuse me, on the income, because I do want to see that. But I guess the question I have is this, and since you understand the school aid formula and the difficulties with that, has there been a cost-benefit analysis that's been run to demonstrate if this is put in place in all the townships that what would happen to our school districts, and not just the rural districts, not just the Bangors and the Melrose Mindoros, but also in the school district that my children attend, Holman, which is growing leaps and bounds, and there's real struggles there.
The answer is no. We certainly have not gone to that level of analysis. One of the things that's recommended in the action items in the comprehensive plan is to do a cost of community services study for additional developments, especially larger developments. That will help us to understand those issues a lot better in the future. We obviously don't understand them perfectly at this point in time.
No, and I do understand that, and you have done a tremendous job here of putting this all together. I just think it's really important that whatever we do, we recognize that we also have a relationship not just with our town governments and our villages and our municipalities, but with our school districts. And the decisions that we make and the decisions they make impact all of us. So thank
yeah,
you.
And I'd like to speak to that point. I think it's a very important point that Brad brings up, is this document is promoting discussions amongst different levels of government, not just school districts, not just towns, villages, and counties, but also police districts, fire districts, and those other things. And so the idea is before we approve new developments, that we consider a lot of those issues and that we invest public dollars, not just here at the county from the county board standpoint, but in all of these other areas of government, we invest them wisely and efficiently. And if we are going to allow development, to ensure that that development pays for itself, that it doesn't increase the taxes for all the residents. And so the idea with this comprehensive plan is to have more of those discussions, have more a thorough understanding of those issues, and I think, in my opinion, this document really helps us to do that.
Ralph Gary.
Thank you. I have a question on this. On page 134, you've got a number 6 that says direct job-creating economic investments to distressed places. These investments would be intended to relieve concentration of long-term unemployed persons, including minorities, developmentally disabled, and the aging, and to encourage the redevelopment of land and buildings for new job creation. Well, when I look at it, the first thing that comes to mind is the city of La Crosse. What does direct job-creating economic investments to distressed places mean?
Well, we have a pretty good demographic analysis of the average wage and different social conditions for most of La Crosse County. And so the idea would be is if we are promoting job growth through incentives, that the promotions should start in those depressed areas. And so using our demographic analysis, we would say if a company is competing in a depressed area with a company that's outside of that depressed area, that they would score higher in some sort of a scoring criteria for receiving any incentives to grow their business in that location.
I still don't quite get how this works in the city of La Crosse. Where the population is located, you might not have the zoning, you know, if the location you're trying to solve the problem with or improve the situation is in one section of town and where they can locate the businesses 10 miles away on the other side of town, is that, you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I understand. And in that case, what we'd probably try to do is either locate the housing or future housing for that demographic population closer to the employment center, or locate the employment center closer to that existing housing, so that first of all they'd have a less expensive commute, so they have less expense in their quality of life for paying for vehicles or travel or whatever, and also then understanding the creation of jobs would happen that would improve their quality of life.
I still don't get it. If you would move the housing to closer to where the factory was or whatever came in here, you're talking building low-income housing units, or what are you talking about?
I don't know yet. I mean, we'll have to analyze all of those issues. If it's new development or if it's redevelopment, building in green farm fields or building in areas that are brown fields, all of those issues are part of this plan. So, you'd have to almost come up with a very specific case of location and style and land use, and then we can take the plan and use it to make some good decisions. That's the idea, is look at that very specific case that you're talking about and apply this plan to that location.
Okay, and let's say number 10, encourage new business development expansion that provides family wage jobs and a strong tax base. I notice we use the word encourage a lot in here. What does encourage mean? Is that an action word, or is it just something that every community probably encourages better jobs? So
I'm gonna,
what does that mean?
I'm going to point to Tom Ralk on that issue. Actually, Tom was very vocal many times, and Charlie Weath, about that word, encourage. Because we had, as Tara said, a lot of meetings, and there's the words direct, there's encourage, there's require, there's the words may, and there's the words shall. All of those words mean different things.
Right.
And encourage means let's attempt to make it happen. And so if you read any of the staff reports of these, they're fairly bare bones. We don't get into the discussions that we had thoroughly in those staff reports because it was myself trying to do the recording of the minutes at the same time as handling the meetings. But those meetings went into very strong detail over wording. And very specific wording was discussed at length in just about every meeting. So if the word encourage is used, more than likely that word encourage was scrutinized heavily by the committee. And the consensus was to say, okay, encourage means let's attempt to get this to happen. If it's require, then it means let's require this to happen.
Further discussion or questions of Charlie before, or and Don, you're up next.
All right, I don't know who answers this, but we all have a packet on our desk of from different towns and such requesting different things, some changes in the comprehensive plan, a 45-day delay. Who's addressing those? Are we answering the Charlie, or are you meeting with him, talking to him about it, or what?
I'm actually meeting with the town of Burns tomorrow night.
And they're the ones that asked for the 45. Okay, and the guy that wrote it is actually on the committee.
That's true.
So it's up to the committee to answer him, is that right?
No. At this point, the committee has adopted a resolution which recommends this draft to you as the county board. By statute, that was the process that the committee needed to take. At this point, this document is yours. So any amendments that need to be made from this point forward need to be made by the county board, or the county board needs to send it back to the committee with a recommendation for them to consider an amendment. But, you know, if you're looking at the timeline of adopting this by March, I wouldn't recommend that.
Well, also I'd point out, in this letter, he mentions the January 10th deadline for input, and they wanted 45 days. They've got it. I mean, we're not voting on this till March, so they will have that 45 days. We tried to be responsive to the concern that they wanted more time to get to us, and I wrote a letter to all of them.
Oh, you have? That's what I was wondering, if someone answered them.
No, I wrote a letter to all of them telling them what our time schedule was, and encouraging them, if anybody had anything that they wanted us to see, to send it to us, and I would get it out to every board member. That's why it's on your desk. Any information that we get between now and when we vote on this in March, you will get.
But the next two letters talk about actual changes, and that's where Charlie will come in, and the discussing with the town of Greenfield and with the town, with Holman. Things that they didn't like, that they wanted to talk about. That
well, the Village of Holman's recommendations are basically how we implement the plan. They're not actually in the drafting of the plan. They're more of an implementation of the plan, especially as they relate to plan amendments that the town of Onalaska is taking a look at and approved. The comments from the town of Greenfield have a concern with the thresholds. And so we have a copy of those thresholds here tonight. They're also in all of your documents if you want to have a discussion about that.
I don't want to have a discussion, but I want to make sure that everyone's been answered and their concerns been put on the table, and it sounds like they have been, and you're dealing with it.
We're trying.
Thank you.
John Menninger, did I see your hand?
Well, yeah, just very briefly, and I back to this word encouraging. That's about the best you can get. It's a positive word. It's an affirmative word. It's a good word. You know, this economic development stuff is tough. It's a dark, cold world out there. And, you know, if it was easy to get jobs and bring them to your community, everybody would do it. Say, hey, vote for me. I'm going to bring 1,000 living wage jobs to the community. Well, but we know that's
easy,
that's a lot easier said than done. You know, these are challenging environments for economic development and job recruitment and job retention. We just saw in the paper this last week that Boscobel, little town of Boscobel, lost a factory with 188 jobs. You can imagine how that devastates a community like that. So, and where are they going? Mexico, you know. So it's, I think you've done the best you can understanding the challenges of bringing in good jobs with good wages. We're all for it. Who's against it? And then in the tough competitive times we are, you do the best you can with what you got. And I think you guys have done a nice job with this. So,
Vicki Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to point out in the town of Greenfield letter, just kind of like to correct misinformation whenever it's given. It says, it talks about there currently is a move to require all new La Crosse district employees. He's talking about school district employees. There are made at least two calls to people in the school district of La Crosse who would be involved in those kinds of negotiations with district employees. I can assure you that they told me that the discussion about La Crosse district employees having to live within the district did not apply to all district employees. It simply applied to administrators.
Tom Roach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably the need to make a comment merely because I was quoted by Charlie and in reference to some of Ralph's question about the use of the word encourage. And frankly, I'm going to name someone else here then, too. On the committee, we had lots of discussions. I agree with what Charlie said and how he characterized that. On the kinds of verbs or words that should be used as action items there. And Jeff Schrader was fairly strongly opposed, as I was, not as much as he, but as I was, about heavy-handed mandates arbitrarily, particularly if they weren't even described very thoroughly. And so we generally, I think, as a community, as a group, that committee backed off of those kinds of words. On the other hand, we didn't want to fail to acknowledge the importance of many of these subjects about where jobs are related vis-a-vis housing and those kinds of things. John Menninger has clearly described the difficulty in implementing that. So we kind of fell to what was both neutral and enthusiastic in choosing that word encourage. And for this board's perspective, we can choose later on after adoption of this plan stronger or weaker encouragement. We can find other ways to make tighter the opportunity by regulation or mandate, or broader the opportunity by financial assistance in many different ways. But all of those ways will come back to this board for their review, revision, and implementation decisions. So the encouragement process will have lots and lots of board participation throughout the full 20-year life of this plan. Thank you.
Any other questions for Charlie before we enter into the discussion and amendments on the plan? Jeff Schrader.
Charlie, can you tell me how this transfer of development rights works? Does that go to individuals, or who does that go to?
Transfer of development rights is more of a market-driven program where it's certainly not nearly as prolific as a purchase of development rights program. What a transfer of development rights does is it calls for sending zones and receiving zones. And the sending zones would be the rural areas where you would have large landowners, large parcels. And those sending zones would send a development right density of one unit per 20 acres or one unit per 40 acres, depending on the program that you set up. The receiving zones would be the more urban areas where they would receive from those sending zones that one unit per 20 acres or one unit per 40 acres. So let's say a developer wants to develop a lot in the city of Onalaska, or a parcel in the city of Onalaska. The city of Onalaska allows him or her to develop 20 units, but they would like to develop 40 units more densely. So they would then go out to the sending area and purchase 20 more units from a rural landowner. That rural landowner would get some financial assistance from that developer, and the developer would be able to develop more densely in the urban area. As you can see, it's a very complicated program, and it's something that hasn't been successfully instituted in many places. There's somewhere between 100 and 200 in the country, so it's not something that's prolific.
So then this, would this take place of our allotments that each township is given?
I have no idea. We haven't looked at it at all.
I mean, I don't remember even discussing this in the process.
We discussed it very briefly in that.
Very must have been very briefly.
And when I said it was complicated, I think that meeting went on to something else fairly quickly.
Brad Path.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charlie, I just have to be clear, because the whole school issue is extremely important to me as a parent. Were the school districts involved in a discussion of this plan?
Yes.
Okay. Did they testify or did they share any type of information on what their feelings are about all of this?
No.
Okay. All right. But your office did reach out to them and ask for
comment. No question. I've met with every school district superintendent, and they were invited to many of these public meetings. Understand that a school district superintendent in no way can make a comment on a comprehensive plan and say the school district of X feels this way unless he or she would take it to their school board and have them vote on it, which obviously they're very busy. And we asked for comments,
right,
and we solicited comments, and I talked individually at a staff level with many of the school district superintendents and also some of the logistics employees. In fact, I've got a meeting on Thursday with the village or with the school district of Holman, they're looking at planning their bus routes for the future.
Yeah.
And so that gives you an idea of how we've involved them in the process, but obviously we haven't gotten official comments from any of the school districts.
I just bring this up for the simple reason that, you know, school aid is so huge in the state budget. It will be one of the defining issues the next legislative session, the next gubernatorial race. And the thing is that, you know, what we do, I just want to make sure what we do here, you know, works cooperatively with what those individual districts and those boards and those taxpayers within those districts are attempting to do within their district. So I'm glad that you're aware and you're working with it. Thank you.
Don Vina.
Two separate comments. The school districts that are growing like Holman do take a hit because the enrollment that their aids are based on is the third Tuesday of October every year. And if you're a growing community, you may have, you know, another 40 or 50 students by the time the end of that school year comes, and you're only getting aids based on the third Thursday of that October. So therefore, you are going to be short, but you'll probably make that up the next year. In regards to TPR, I think we'd have to get into a whole new system of allocating credits to property owners in and around the county if we got into TPR. You know, PDR is complicated enough, but then you throw TPR on the top of it. There are some communities out east, and we did take a trip out there, and we saw a little bit about what they're doing. But you would have to, as a county, allocate credits to property owners, which could negotiate with the developers, and I'm not sure if we want to really get that complicated in our county. It's something that could work, and the property owners, if they have property, could sell those credits to the developers, and it gets to be a complicated scenario. But there are some townships who have questions. The plan came out to them about the 1st of December. We had the public hearing on in Onalaska on December 10th, and they hadn't at that point met to discuss this because they were putting their town budgets together. There are some questions out there, but I don't think they're that serious of questions, and that's why some of these guys wrote. I did give my book to the town of Greenfield, and I did go to their meeting, and I tried to answer some questions, but they still, I'm not sure if they were satisfied with the answers or not, and that was not negative as a relation to the comp plan, but there still are some questions out there, and I guess Charlie's going to try to answer them for some of the people.
Margaret Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Charlie, I don't know if this is just an economic development office situation or part of the comprehensive plan. As I look on page 110 for the economic development goals, my question is, when we do encourage businesses to come in, do we have a particular focus of the kind of business so that we're not inviting a business that would ultimately put another business at a disadvantage or close them down to open the new one, that we're not just trading the same number of jobs? I mean, I know there has to be competition in a free market system, but do we at all look at that kind of thing, that we're not putting one business out to bring another business in and not really gain any jobs?
I would have to say not really, because of that competition issue. When we look at businesses as they come to our office to request assistance, most of the time our assistance is in locational analysis, in giving them, getting an understanding from them what they need as far as space, the style of building, the, you know, if they need loading docks, then all of a sudden we've got some transportation issues. Do they need large trucks? What traffic analysis, et cetera? So we get a real personality from that business, and we give them some locations in the county that we think that they'll work, that their business will succeed in. Then their next question is obviously, how much money can you give us? And those questions, first of all, we've got some very strict standard sets as far as how many jobs they're creating, how many they're maintaining, and then the average wage of those jobs. And if they meet some minimum standards, then they can meet minimum qualification standards to apply. They have to meet those standards to even make an application to the business fund or economic development fund, I'm sorry, for a loan, for a low-interest loan. So they go through a fairly substantial screening process, but from a competition standpoint, that's not something that we typically look at.
Thank you, Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to make a comment about this idea that this whole comprehensive plan was not available to people before December 10th. As Chairman Johnson mentioned, the existing conditions report, the issues, visions, and goals, and the land use plan of this comprehensive plan were all available by June 7th. As a matter of fact, we voted on that land use plan in June of 07. So that's the first 119 pages. The remainder, the La Crosse County recommendations and policies and the La Crosse County implementation element, then makes up the rest of the 149 pages, which would be 30 pages that were not. Now, I know that in the town of Onalaska, there was a resident who picked up the draft at the end of October, that it was available. And I don't think, you know, the plan came, you know, the large amount of this plan was available to people to read and to study much before December 10th, as was the draft available. And Charlie has done a very good job of, and the staff, of putting it on the La Crosse County Board site, and people have the ability to go in there and to look at what has been done and to read that from that site. So, you know, that sort of falls on deaf ears to me, I guess, because since December 10th, now we've had the 63 days, and I really don't think that we've had a lot of comments from some of those townships that were indicating that they didn't have enough time. But I just want to point out, when we look at practically what is in the plan and what was available, that we realize it's those 30 pages we're talking about of the last two sections of the plan, which involve the La Crosse County recommendations and policies and the La Crosse County implementation.
Okay, Charlie, thank you very much. Now we're going to get into any discussion people have, any amendments people wish to offer, so on and so forth. Ralph Geary.
Thank you. I don't have an amendment, but we're going to vote on this in March?
Correct.
Okay. At the policy meeting in March, you know, I'm reading this letter from the Village of Holman from Catherine Schmidt, and she's got some specific things like, is opposed to any development of area with a slope in excess of 12%, is opposed to cluster developments. I'd like some more information on why they're opposed to it. Maybe we should have them here so we can ask them questions on their letters. If I'd call them up, then the other 33 people wouldn't hear what she told me for an answer or something. They've got very specific things she put in her letter. Some of them didn't. They're more general, but she was pretty specific on what they're opposed to. So could we have them here?
Well, the planning meeting for March is going to be the Lakeview business or the Lakeview development.
We also have a presentation on the natural steps.
Okay, so yeah, it really couldn't happen then. Certainly next week at the first reading of the ordinance, if anybody wants to you know, have any further discussion. We don't do public hearings here, obviously, and so I don't want to say, let's tell Holman to come, because then what if other people? No, I don't want them all to come either. It's not a public hearing.
We sent the letter now, so.
I mean,
okay, never mind.
If people, hold on a second, if people have questions on using the Holman letter as an example, I would encourage you to talk with them and ask them to send clarifications to you in writing that you can share with the board. That way, it won't be just what you hear. It will be everybody seeing the same document. And, you know, we certainly want as much information as we can get. Margaret Wood.
Is there a tape of any of the public hearings available to be listened to?
Charlie?
The only public hearing that was recorded was our public hearing on December 10th.
Pardon? Somebody else had a point of order. I don't know who that was. Okay. George Hammes.
Charlie, is this on the agenda for the Towns Association later this month?
I talked with Bob Crooks, who's the chair of the Towns Association, and he asked if I could attend that meeting, and that meeting is on February 21st. So I declined to attend because I'll be here at the county board meeting on the 21st for your first reading of this ordinance. So I do not know if it's on that agenda or not.
It's on the 21st?
February 21st.
Right. It is. It's the same night as our county board meeting.
Well, that's nice. Town of Holland's hosting it.
So apparently you won't be here that night, or else you won't be there. Yes, and I had earlier talked to Bob Crooks and suggested the same thing. I think that's why. Did he call you, Charlie? So I don't know how we're going to be able to do that, but they have been encouraged to talk about it, get us any comments they have. Let me put out a call for amendments that people want to throw out, whether they are completely formed or partially formed ideas that you have. Here's what I don't want to have happen. People walk in the March meeting and hand out a complicated amendment, and people look at it and say, I have no idea what this means. Please, if you have some ideas, or some current concerns, let's get them out now. Bill can start drafting them, and don't even think about bringing in an amendment that Bill hasn't drafted, or it's just going to be absolute chaos. It will not work trying to shove it into the ordinance, so you know, please follow that procedure. So does anybody have any concerns tonight that you would like to address, at least have the board think about? Mr. Ebert.
Yes, I anticipate some sort of a resolution to get rid of the threshold.
Okay. Anybody want to have any discussion on that issue tonight, the thresholds? Explain, first of all, what they are. So not everybody may know what those are. Tara Johnson?
If I could ask Supervisor Ebert a question, are you saying all of the thresholds? I know there had been some talk among some supervisors about the commercial land use thresholds, taking those out and leaving in the residential thresholds.
My primary would be all thresholds, although the commercial are probably more important. But, yeah, I just the idea of the county, I have more trust the more closer to government, to the people the government is. And, therefore, I think the townships have a better idea what they want to do. And I'm not sure. We don't like when the state tells us what to do, and I'm not sure we should be telling the townships what to do.
George Amos.
I wholeheartedly agree. You know, you give development in the county. This here is trying to distribute the development all through the county. That means your basic services that you got to provide are spread out much thinner. If you have development, especially in the commercial areas, in the areas where commercials is going to want to develop, near your highway systems, near your rail systems, you can provide the services much easier. I think when you put this grid in there, and I argued when the board passed it back in June, I think you're encouraging the developers to annex to municipalities rather than develop in the townships. And I just, you know, if we get upset every time the state of Wisconsin comes in and says, we have to do something. Well, this here is Big Brother telling the townships what they have to do. And I disagree with it totally. if we as a county tried to impose this onto the city of La Crosse or the city of Onalaska, you'd really hear some screaming.
George, let me ask you the same question that Tara asked Mr. Ebert, which is, are you concerned about residential and commercial or mainly commercial?
I'm more concerned with the commercial part, but I think they both should be taken out.
Okay. Don Vina.
I guess that is one of my concerns, because I was now to a number of town meetings, and Town of Greenfield has a problem with their allocation of residential in the plan. I think they're looking at bigger lots than what we are kind of anticipating, and I'm not sure where they're even looking, but in 10 years, I think they're, I didn't look it up, 145 acres maybe in 10 years or something like that for the Town of Greenfield.
121.
Well, the chairman was pretty emphatic about that when he talked during the course of his last month's meeting. And today I had an invitation last month to attend Barry Mills, and I couldn't make it because we had a meeting that night. I stopped there today to see what time their meeting was, and it's tomorrow night at 7:30, and I will be there if everything goes okay at home. They have a request from two property owners right now for 340 acres for residential. It ain't going to happen. But he's allocated, I think, 145 in Barry Mills. The allocated number that townships got are a problem with a number of townships. In addition to what George Hamas is saying, so that is something that I'm not sure what we ought to do about, because I'm not sure how to approach it. Charlie did an analysis along with zoning, and their formula seemed pretty agreeable, but nobody knows in the next 10 years what's going to happen. And the next step would be, if a township's run out of eligible acres in 6 years, let's say, what's the process by which they could borrow an allocated number from another township? We don't have any plan that I know of at this point in time as to how to redistribute those acres, if it's at all possible. Or does everything after year six get voted down until the end of the 10-year plan? I really don't know. It's not an amendment to the plan, but should we have some of these in the plan is what it amounts to.
Jason Gillette.
Thank you. What exactly is a threshold?
Charlie, why don't you answer that?
The reason these thresholds have been placed in this plan is to utilize the demographic data that we have. The demographic data says this is what we expect as far as development needs in the unincorporated areas of La Crosse County in the next 20 years. Okay? And understand, this has been put into a table that says 10 years. So it's basically twice the allocation for development that we expect in the next 10 years. So what this threshold has done is it's put a number out there that we should take a look at when development is being proposed in these towns. And so if there's 340 acres being proposed in the town of Barrie, and we look at the threshold, and the threshold shows that our demographic analysis shows a need for 160 acres of development, we should be concerned about that proposal. And we should really review that proposal with a fine-tooth comb and understand that there's not a demand for 340 acres of development in the town of Barrie. If that development goes in, we can expect it to be vacant, or at least a portion of it to be vacant, and then we need to maintain the public roads And depending on how the lots are sold, there'll be, you know, much of that land in that 340 acres continues to be vacant. It's not responsible to our taxpayers. So the threshold is meant to be critiquing developments that are proposed so that we can understand from these thresholds if it's a good proposal or not. And if the developer can come in and convince us that this 340-acre development is a good thing for the town of Barrie and a good thing for the La Crosse County, then they get their approval. Then we amend this threshold, we amend the plan, but it gives us a number to critique it. The threshold is really an analysis number.
Margaret Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just like to remind our fellow supervisors here that no man is an island. And I think on page 3, when it talks about regional context and dynamics, it lists 14 areas to look at and be concerned about as we make this decision. And I think in other areas, tourism, transportation, a lot of our committees have gone regionalized as opposed to just, you know, the people we represent. So I think we've got a nice context and a very holistic way of looking at how we decide to manage the comprehensive plan or have the comprehensive plan manage us. And I guess I would just remind people to read page 3 as we contemplate amendments.
Jeff Schrader.
Thank you. My concern is I don't feel the county has enough flexibility in their plan. As you know, all you know that all these things are being their ordinances, and the townships are, every time they want to change their plans now, they have to go through the whole scenario of redraft or drafting a new ordinance and having it read and everything. And then the county then is not going to even look at any of the township's bushes only once a year, the way I understand the way this is written. So I think there needs to be something in here that the county can take a look at our ordinance when a township decides that they want to change something without waiting a year. I think it's too unwieldy. I think it kind of portrays us as the big brother, and as this thing was being established, it was with a carrot and a stick, and I think this is a stick. So,
Leanne Paff.
Thank you. Charlie, I have a problem with these thresholds also, but the only thing about it, if you take the thresholds out of your plan, you pretty well take the guts out of the whole comprehensive plan. But when you look at these thresholds, they're just not going to hold up anyway, because they're going to change it. I mean, Farmington is... You know, Farmington is really a double township, and you have them down for a total of 440 acres over the next 10 years, and you have Holland, which is half the size in area-wise, at 760. I know they have the tradition of growth, but you have to look where the growth is going to be after the growth is fulfilled in one area. You know, so, I mean, some of these things, and when you talk about Don's idea of trading land, that's going to be, you know, who's going to hold each other up for that? I mean, if you start trading land between townships or anything like that, I foresee this as a big problem. I would like to, if Mr. Ebert made that into a motion, I would be, in a way, willing to vote in favor of the motion to drop the thresholds. But if you drop the thresholds, you'd have to admit it really hurts your plan. That's why I would. You don't think it does? Okay, explain that.
Well, the thresholds are an analysis tool. That's it. That's basically what the plan is. It's an analysis tool. And as far as Jeff's point about amending the plan on a more often basis, then why plan? I mean, why do you have a plan if you're going to amend it monthly? That's a real questionable activity in my mind. Is planning is long-range planning. Yeah, but the point of these thresholds, you've certainly stumbled upon it. The town of Greenfield doesn't think they have enough acres. The town of Farmington doesn't think they have enough acres. The town of Holland doesn't think they have enough acres. The town of Hamilton doesn't think they have enough acres. But the demand, historically, in demographic analysis, in looking at the jobs creation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, says this is what the market will bear. This is not us putting numbers here as planners that are conservative numbers. By no means are these conservative numbers. If I had my druthers, these numbers would be cut in half to be the exact allocation of what the demographic projection is for the next 10 years. But each of these towns would like to grow at double or triple or quadruple this pace. What does that do to the market for all of these other towns? What does that do to the market for the cities and the municipalities? And what does it do for our consideration of, well, where should this growth go? And planning. If we take our analysis tools out so that we don't look like Big Brother,
I'm afraid economics drive it more than
no
than
question.
Planning.
The market.
So I mean,
the demographic analysis is predicting
goes.
What the market will be.
That's I don't know. That's going to work.
George Hamas.
Well, personally, I don't see the town of Holland growing to the numbers that you have in here. But I know, especially when it comes to commercial development, say you have someone come in and develop 100 acres of commercial in the town of Holland and has it all plotted out, has some sold. Then you have something big that comes in that's going to automatically jump over this level in another parcel. But the thing is, then you say, well, you're over your allotment. Then we got to go back and go through the regulatory thing of changing everything that we can proceed. And by that time, you lose the business. I'm saying I don't think we need a quota. I think you got the quota of how many acres in the township over the next 10 years, 20 years, what you've spelled out in your plan. But I think that the development is going to go where it's most advantageous to the developer when it's done. I think putting these restrictions on the townships is not right.
Jeff Schrader.
You know, maybe Charlie and George just hit on the solution to this. I think a good plan is a flexible plan, as far as I'm concerned. And because these thresholds are set, and it sounds like, unless they're completely done away with, if we had more flexibility on the county's part of reviewing these town plans, maybe three times a year, not every month, maybe this would solve the whole problem. I'd like the planning department to think about that.
I have a question on that issue that George talked about in terms of going, you know, a big development comes in and so forth, and I want to use Town of Holland as an example. What you have listed for non-residential acres is 140 for the Town of Holland, so that would be the commercial, right? Okay. If we have this set up that there's going to be presumably this annual review, would that annual review include the threshold numbers too?
Certainly could.
So if somebody came in and took a big chunk tomorrow of that 140, then you could look at that again in that annual review?
That's exactly the idea of the thresholds, is when you start to approach them, that's the time to review them before you get a developer in that wants to go over them. So the idea of the thresholds is, when you start to approach them, then you better start reviewing whether they should be amended.
And George, because I used a ton of Holland, I'll let you make a comment.
Okay, for an example, we had a developer that wanted to develop 260 acres of commercial and do it in phases. But they have to, in purchasing the land, they have to have some guarantee that once phase one is filled to a certain point, that they can go to phase two and to phase three. So, I mean, they want to rezone it now that in the future, when they get to that point, they can develop it. But by this plan, number one, it wouldn't allow that much. And then you turn around and the plan says we can go to an X number amount. Well, then you got somebody next to them wants to develop. Well, the town, you've already got this much rezoned for commercial, so you can't rezone this parcel. So that parcel turns around and says, well, we're going to annex to the village because water and sewer is right next to it, and we don't have to listen to this plan.
Tom Rauch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think 3 points on this discussion. First of all, I would hope that sooner rather than later we can drop this discussion about trading or borrowing allocations. My recollection is that whole idea of between townships trading or borrowing came up only as a question in regard to how this might be implemented, never because it was put in writing or declared an intent, and it has not subsequently been declared an intent. The discussion of trading or bartering between townships is not generic to this discussion. It has never been part of this plan and shouldn't be drug on any further in the discussion, please. Second point. Planners mostly try to frame an image of the future based on their very best efforts to garner facts that lead them to logical projections, which is exactly where these numbers came from. Planning department, using statistical and demographic data for all of our townships, tried to quantify a reasonable projection of what those townships had already experienced and line that out to the future for 20 years, and then doubled it and said, now this is the 10-year projection. So it is not as if these numbers, whichever township you want to talk about, were made willy-nilly or arbitrarily or anything else. And so it seems to me appropriate for those of us that want to say any given township has the wrong number, that there should be some obligation to reference to quantifiable fact in history. Show us how your experience has led you to believe a different number is appropriate. Let's talk with reference to facts in history and then together try to make projections for the future. It's not as if these are locked in, arbitrary, complete, and mandatory. They are not. These are projections based on people trying to do the best projections. And so, therefore, my final point, and that is, I would please implore my fellow supervisors to go back to page 121, where this matrix is, where table 1 is, and please read, again, paragraphs A, B, and C above it. It talks about the purpose of these thresholds is to define points at which the town, the local and community plans will need to be reviewed and updated. It doesn't say somebody gets shot if we exceed these numbers. It doesn't say...
Is that an amendment?
Not yet. It doesn't say that nothing can ever happen within 10 years beyond these numbers. It says, let's talk. Let's continue the planning process. Paragraph B amplifies on that. It merely says these should be, I'll quote Charlie's word on this, these shall be the triggers that initiate that discussion. And if we're doing a good job as county elected officials and the town people are doing a good job as their elected officials in anticipating this and finding the trends before they happen and drive us through this, we will have very orderly discussions. We will reach a conclusion that that works for everybody, and it's not as if these are absolute, mandatory, and final. Thank you.
Steve O'Malley has a comment.
You know, I haven't engaged very much in this this discussion about comp planning, but I do think if people are interested in long-term means of controlling property taxes, it's as simple as looking in your capital improvement plan. Remember, we just went through two sets of road studies, and the second road study identified close to $20 million worth of unfunded roads that, quite frankly, about 70% of the cost of that unmet and unfunded road analysis will be funded by urban taxpayers. The reason for that is that we have had basically unrestricted or unquestioned, to a large extent, development in this county for quite some time. The concept of thresholds, particularly in residential area, but also in commercial, where we've got to think through what we can afford to provide in services, what we can afford to provide in roads, really is the point of planning. If we believe that unrestricted development has no cost, look at your capital improvement plan that has that whole unfunded column in it from the last road study. The fact is that we are barely able to keep up with just maintaining existing roads as they are right now, and we have, Charlie, what's the last figure? I think how many platted undeveloped lots are out there right now already, forgetting about future development?
There's roughly 1,000 vacant lots.
There are 1,000 vacant lots right now that, to keep up with demand of the road system to service those lots as we exist right now, we have not yet have a plan or a funding stream to pay that other than just existing maintenance. If we fund that additional road system without new developments, without new platting, 70% of that will be borne by urban taxpayers. So anyone that thinks this is a town can just make its own decisions independent of the urban areas and control county property taxes, we're all in this together, folks. And we need to figure out how to work together to deal with, yes, it sounds terrible to say control development, but we can't afford to just have hundreds and hundreds, and what did you say, 1,000 platted, undeveloped lots that is beyond what the market can support right now, and we can't afford, I don't have a plan yet, and you have not asked me to develop a plan yet, to pay for the road system that needs to support the development that's already out there. This is about controlling long-term property taxes. This is about controlling long-term costs of schools, long-term costs of village services, and frankly, the majority of the taxes that pay for these services, for these roads, forget county patrol, forget any other service, just roads, 70% is by urban taxpayers. We need to work together. We need to figure out a way to have this dialogue respectfully and to talk about what do thresholds mean, how do we trigger that. But this is not academic. This is not just, oh, well, it's a planning exercise. It's in your budget document. It's in your capital improvement plan. We already can't afford to do the road system that demands just from existing development. I do think to consider that as you deliberate what level of thresholds, whether you have them or not, it's not free. County services, school services, village services are not free.
Ralph Geary.
Thank you. Charlie, if you have the thresholds or not, does the same thing occur? The town approves a rezoning that comes to the county board for approval or disapproval. You as an administrator or the zoning department or whoever will, if we had the thresholds in here or not, you make a recommendation. I think 100 acres in Barrie is too much because our projections say if there's only demand for 10 acres or something. Isn't that going to occur the same way?
Actually, no. Because the towns, what we've pledged is that we will accept these town plans by reference. Okay? That goes into our recommended land use map that's in this plan. And so if you take, for example, the town of Onalaska, their recommended land use map allows for approximately 340 acres of conservation residential. That's a low-density cluster-type residential subdivision, which our thresholds show there's not a market for in all of La Crosse County for that many acres of that style of development. But because their plan allows it in that many acres,
it without the thresholds, if a developer came in with a rezoning request and it was in one of those recommended land use maps showing that that was an appropriate location for it, our staff recommendation would be to approve. And if a developer came in every month until they hit that threshold, our recommendation would be to approve. Once they go over that threshold, our recommendation would be to deny, even though it would be within a land use classification that would allow it. Okay? Without the thresholds, then we just continue to recommend approval. So there's no discussion as we approach that threshold whether it's appropriate or not to have that many acres. The only discussion is locational analysis, and because these towns have used large acreages to be more flexible, we don't have a discussion about the thresholds.
I still didn't get the answer to that question.
I can.
If somebody wants to do something in a township that, right, and they need rezoning, right, how do they get it?
Okay, we look at the plan as a staff, and we make a recommendation to the PR&D committee whether it's consistent with the plan.
Okay, let's say it's not.
Then we recommend denial.
Okay, and if it comes, and if the town passes it and the county board passes it, does it approve?
Yes.
Okay.
The staff's recommendation.
If you didn't have thresholds or you had them in there, then it wouldn't matter on new rezoning, you're saying.
Well,
if it's coming in to get rezoned.
With that same thought process, the plan doesn't matter at all.
No, on that one particular issue. We might take the administration recommendation 9, but the 10th time, maybe the township made a compelling argument on why they should be allowed to exceed
the thresholds are in place. The 10th time we'd have the discussion whether it was appropriate or not. If the thresholds aren't in place, it's not the 10th time, it's not the 20th time, it's not the 30th time, because there's no threshold in place.
But you'd still make a recommendation if you had a threshold or not.
Right.
John Menninger asked me the question about whether we should be having amendments put on the floor at this point, and my thinking on that is no. That a lot of board members, even though this is a very critical issue, one of the most important things that we're doing during this term of office, a lot of people just aren't familiar with the nuances of this comprehensive plan. And so I wanted to have as much kind of freewheeling type of discussion as possible so as to bring people up to speed on these issues. And so I like the discussion that's going on so far, and I'm not reining anybody in terms of saying, no, you got to put an amendment on the floor, because I'm hoping that what will happen is this discussion will lead to some ideas that somebody might say, well, okay, having heard that, let's try an amendment this way or whatever the case may be. So if people want to make amendments, you're certainly welcome to, but for purposes of where we're at tonight, I'm comfortable with us just talking and trying to hash some of these things out. And you know, if it starts to get too repetitive and we're not learning anything further, I'll try to move it along. But so far, and I think people are making some really good points on you know, all the different sides of this issue, so I'm not cutting anybody off yet. And there are a few more hands that I, see here. I'm going to try to cover people that mostly who have not talked yet or have talked less than some other folks, and you know, give people a chance to, everybody have their 2 cents worth, and that gets us to you, JC.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My main question is the word or the term threshold, is that needed? And would it lose its effect if another word was substituted? For this reason, thinking about the word threshold, I think of the word limitation. And in the sense of that, it is a limitation or a economic projection, as we have been saying, of development, in which we should take a step back and let's see how this will affect others. However, also hearing what you've had to say, Mr. Handy, is that it's not necessarily a limitation in enforcement and in policy. If there is a valid reason in which we can have some development, can this be termed as a guideline or stated as economic projection, a developed marker or development marker in which development beyond a certain historical statistic requires joint discussions and review?
And that's really the, I think, the concept that the committee wanted. Was when we start to approach these, whatever you call them, whatever term is most acceptable, that we have those discussions. Is this an appropriate development at this point in time? And if
you know, if you can come up with a way that improves upon that, I think that's a great idea.
Charlie, I don't know if it's been made clear tonight, and not in my mind. If we're in a town and we're getting close to that threshold and we have a proposal that comes in now that would put us over that threshold, and we're not at that once-a-year mark, what happens?
Basically, the staff would recommend denial of additional development to the PR&D committee. The PR&D committee would take that under advisement and make a decision to recommend to the county board to approve or deny based on the information that they had with that proposal, and the county board would make a decision whether to approve or deny based on the information they had with that proposal. So what it does is it gives us the threshold where we as a staff would say, you've surpassed this threshold without amending it, so we recommend denial.
So that's really all it is? It's not like they have to come back at the end of the year or something like that? It could be...
Depends on how you vote as a committee and how you vote as a county board.
Well, my question is how the comp plan ordinance reads right now. Would they be required to only make that request once a year, or could that request be made mid-year and the board approve it mid-year, or must it wait till that annual review?
The comp plan reads that it must be amended at least once a year.
So
the terminology at least says, you know, we recommend once a year, mm-hmm. but you can do it more often than that.
So if we amended it last month, but in the town of Onalaska something comes in today that puts us over the threshold, and I say, hey, this is a great idea, even though we amended it last month, it could come in now. Is that what you're saying?
If you felt that way as a county board, certainly could.
Okay. I just wanted
this
to
plan allows that flexibility.
Okay. I wasn't clear on that, so thank you. Anybody who has not talked once yet on this, I got people who are repeat customers here, but are there any people who have not spoken yet that want to have a chance? Because I want to give you folks first. Okay. Round whatever, Vicki Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My comments were going to be to ask about the undeveloped lot, which Mr. O'Malley did, and to recommend that people read again A and B, which really explains that whole idea of threshold, I think, in that it's essential in planning to look where you are and what you're doing means for the future. But, for example, could you tell me, Charlie, in the town of Burns, for example, in the last 10 years, how many non-residential acres have been developed in commercial?
I certainly couldn't give you an exact number off the top of my head. There has been some in the town of Burns. It's less than 40 acres, but there are some non-residential acres that have developed in the town of Burns.
Okay, but it certainly wouldn't have approached that number in the town of Burns.
No.
Or in, I mean, I'm, or the town of Barrie, for example, in the last 10 years. You wouldn't have had 40 acres of commercial development.
No.
I mean, to me, when you say these are really not very conservative estimates, they are pretty generous in what they allow.
Just a point on that issue. Eve Zellmer is on our Comprehensive Plan Steering Committee. She also represents strongly, and many of you members on the Steering Committee understand that term, strongly, the Builders Association. And the Builders Association is not concerned with these threshold numbers.
No, and that's the point I wanted to make, that's based upon... when you look at the experience with those townships. And to me, it is really, if we're going to be responsible people, I think we have to use the all of the demographics that we gather. I mean, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out those things in relationship to school districts and to other things about trying to project. And we did the same thing when we talked about building the law enforcement center, and we gather a lot of information, and just to kind of ignore it in our planning, I think, is not being responsible about it. But as Supervisor Rock said about you know, these are thresholds, these are something to guide, and I don't see them as being conservative or restricting at all.
Red Paff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do agree with George Hammes that economic development does follow transportation corridors. I do recognize that. I also agree with Vicki Burke that some of this commercial development, I would love to see in the town of Farmington 40 acres of commercial. I mean, that would absolutely be wonderful. But that's why there is a, that's why this conversation is, it's so big, for the simple reason that, you know, there's a lot of these townships, quite frankly, that don't want to fall behind. But at the same time, let's face it, many of these townships may not get ever to these type of commercial levels. So what do we do? You know, what do we do? We don't want to create pockets of poverty, both in our rural areas as well as our urban areas. But we also do recognize that economic development does follow transportation corridors. And in some of these rural townships, there isn't a major artery, transportation artery. So, you know, we can have this conversation about thresholds, but, I mean, let's be realistic. It is a conversation to take place for the simple reason that many of these areas do not want to fall behind. So the real conversation we could have, and we're not going to have here, because I don't even know if we have the authority to do it, is talk about shared revenue. Is talking about, you know what, if we cannot have commercial development in some of these real rural areas, maybe the areas that are growing, are having commercial development, start recognizing that there are partners that are out here in some of these rural areas, or even the urban areas. Even the urban areas, downtown La Crosse, the Hood Park area. You know, there needs to be that kind of conversation. And we are a growing county. We are a county that's growing. We are a county that's growing population-wise as well as economically. And that would be a real hard conversation to have. But we're not having that conversation. Instead, we're going to have a conversation on thresholds. And there will be amendments that will be offered, and we'll determine if it's good to leave it with the local units of government, townships, or if we do it here at the county. But I think we all need to recognize that nobody wants to fall behind. Everybody wants to see, you know, their local unit of government succeed and grow. Following what Mr. Hammes said, you know, economic development generally does follow transportation corridors. Those are my comments, and thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I have three more people on the list, and then I think that we probably have had it for the night. I see people nodding off and don't want anybody to start snoring and be really embarrassing here. So, Leon, you're third to the last.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. O'Malley mentioned that, you know, that we can't afford the growth that we've had in the last few years and the way things are. But what that leads me to wonder, why are we third or fifth lowest per capita tax rate? We didn't get there by not growing. We got to continue to grow. You know, and you maybe say we can't grow at the rate we are. Why not? Why can't we grow at the rate we're not? Why don't we want to stay at the lowest per capita? I mean, that's something to be pretty proud of. We're proud of it other days, but yet you want to put controls on. Controls hasn't worked since Nixon when he tried it with price controls. They don't work. In the same way we're trying to put economic controls on things. You can't get it without reason, you know.
Far be it from me to be compared to Nixon, but thank you so much. The point that I was trying to make is we can't afford the road needs that we have now, given the, because you have $20 million worth of unmet road needs that are not funded right now among the existing to service the development that's out there. They don't generate enough taxes from the development that's out there to pay for that road system. It will be the urban taxpayers that will pay for the unmet road needs right now. For getting new development, just retroactively speaking, the road study identified nearly $20 million of unmet road needs that taxpayers today have to pay for. Development, particularly residential development, does not pay for itself. That's what the cost of community services said.
Cross County's growth has been bad, then, you're saying.
I'm saying it doesn't support the cost of services to it.
Who's going to pay for it, then?
Urban taxpayers.
That's why your mill rate in the city of La Crosse is one of the reasons why it's so high.
Okay, Don Bina, you have the second to last word.
I thank you again, Mr. Chair. a number of things. With what Steve O'Malley was talking about, you know, some of us who sit on the zoning committee, we did limit some people from developing in the past. And I can go up to the town of Greenfield, who has a unusually large amount of vacant lots. And when the issue came up with one of the my constituents, who won't talk to me to this day yet, and they wanted to develop 120 acres because he was going to lose his home, and he wanted to build a new house, and he wanted to develop all 120 acres. Well, it wasn't going to happen because there were too many sites available already, and we did turn him down. Now, if he would have came for one site because he was going to move it, or five sites, it might have got approved. But we were restricting zoning on the zoning committee for any number of years. I don't want in some way to lose a business that's going to add to our tax base, because that municipality has not got enough acres to take, you know, along the lines what George Hammes was talking about. I don't want to lose that business to Monroe County because they're giving free land away. And in some way, you know, we are doing some of that already. And in some way, we need to figure out a system when you reach your max, you know. And the only thing I could think of is to borrow from another municipality who isn't going to use it. You can have all of town of Washington housing allocation if you want, because they don't want any houses up there. Not any more than they have to. And, you know, granted, the chairman from the town of Barrie today told me that they don't need that big development because the cost for the infrastructure was going to be substantial. And so they're revising their plans on the 340 acres, and they may come in with something else. I don't know what it's going to be, and I haven't talked to anybody except him. Things like after the Ridgeview Inn burned down on the ridge, and I think all of you know where that was, the guy that owned it decided he wasn't going to rebuild, and he put in for, well, with a couple of realtors, they decided to put houses up there, a 96 lots at one time. Now, maybe that's the wrong thing to do, because I'm not sure, I didn't go count the houses lately up there, but there's probably 25 to 28 houses in there out of 96 lots that are standing there. People are finding better, more secluded places to build than in a big addition like that, and that's why we're having the problems. Maybe the development we put together for the future should be smaller in nature and not all the 96, but then the developer probably isn't going to buy the land, or that adds to other problems. So the allocated numbers that township have are a problem with at least three in my area, and I only got four townships there.
Bill Shepard has a point he would like to make.
It seems like a lot of the discussion in the last hour or so,
maybe 2 hours, has been centered
around the amendment process, and I would urge all of you to take a look at page 146 of the comprehensive plan, and particularly pay attention to 8B3 and 8B4, which I think should hopefully ease some of your concern about this. The third subsection talks about the county comprehensive plan may be amended at any time following the statutory procedure. Four talks about to keep current with municipal actions, La Crosse County will update the plan land use map at least annually. So that's really what this document says in terms of amendment, and I think you should be aware of that.
Mr. Bina, is this the a filibuster?
The only way we can put an amendment on the county board floor is if the county board members vote to consider it during the course of that year except for February.
No.
And that is the limiting factor.
No, that's not a correct statement, Mr. Bina. A person can bring in that proposal at any time they wish to.
That's you what, need, you
that's
need
what Bill just read, is that you can amend the plan at any time. That's what he just read. It says at least once a year. It doesn't say more than once a year. It says at least once a year.
I'll come back to the next meeting and get the answer.
Tom Rauch, you have the last word, unless people overrule me and insist on staying later.
No. I'm going to try to be brief. I've been thinking about the words used by Supervisor Gamroth, and I would like to thank her for her insights into this issue. She seems to have put her finger on the point that some of us are seeing this word threshold as an obstacle and others are not. And so, for several reasons, I'd like to first describe that not as an obstacle, but as an opportunity. And if the word threshold, which appears six times on page 121, is a stumbling block for some folks, Supervisor Gamroth suggested perhaps it could be more neutral and opportunistic, give us the opportunity to make positive change. If we changed it to the word marker, I've thought maybe an initiator, where it initiates the discussion between towns and the county and developers and others. But that's the point. It starts the discussion. It tells us that there's an important reason to start a discussion. And if threshold is the problem, let's change the word. Thank you very much.
Apparently, Mr. Hammes is not going to let me end this, so I will call on Mr. Hammes.
In the last year or so, we had a study done in the town of Holland by the University Extension. For every assessed, dollar we spend in the town of Holland on from the residential tax base, it costs like $1.14 to provide the services. From every dollar we collect from commercial, it's like 50 cents that we spend. And the only way you keep your school taxes down is to have a commercial tax base. Now, my big thing with the thresholds here is the commercial end. I think if commercial business comes, we have to be flexible and be ready to go. You know, if we have 1,000 extra lots in this county, maybe this county board says, as a policy, we will not approve any more subdivisions until we get down to 500 lots in the county. I think that would make sense. But when you start to make it difficult, if something commercial comes along, and I don't see it being developed to the extent that maybe what the threshold is, it probably won't get there. But I think you got to be flexible and have it available.
All right. If people have amendments, talk to Bill and he will draft them. I think I hear two thus far, which eliminate thresholds or whatever we're going to call them as it relates to residential. Another one, eliminate thresholds as it relates to commercial, and then I think Mr. Rauch or Ms. Gamroth may have something in terms of the lingo that we're going to use to apply to that.
Steve, I made a promise to the village of Holman that I would ensure that all of you had seen their letter. So I want to make sure that you saw the letter that the village of Holman drafted with their comments to the plan. We had indication from the village of Holman that they felt that we didn't review that letter thoroughly enough, so I want to make sure that I indicate to you that they did write a letter and that you've seen it. Okay, thank you.
It's the third one in your packet. All right, is there a motion to adjourn? By Jill Billing, second by Don Meyer. All in favor, say aye. Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.